Case number 07-3131 et al. United States of America v. Gerald W. Elin, Appellant. Case number 07-3135 et al. United States of America v. Timothy R. Thomas, Appellant. Trial 1. Mr. Smith for Appellant Thomas, Mr. Hart for Appellant Miller, and Mr. Coleman for the government.
Good morning. I expect that the government's argument today will focus on the question of harmless error rather than on whether the court and the government erred. So I will try to focus my remarks in the limited time available on the issue of harmless error as well. And I believe that each issue in this case requires a different harmless error analysis, so I will address these issues seriatim. I think it's a mistake to lump them all together.
Could I just be clear, what is Mr. Hart going to address? Just so I know what issues to focus on.
Excuse me, Your Honor, I'm a little hard of hearing.
What issue is Mr. Hart going to discuss?
Oh, he's going to discuss the overview witness issue.
Thank you. All right.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I believe it is impossible for the government to argue harmless error on the jury deliberation issue. We address this issue in our opening brief at page 43, and note that both the Yanny Court and the Evanston Court, that is the Ninth Circuit, discussed this and noted that in those cases the government did not even make a harmless error argument because of the difficulty or impossibility of arguing that when a court interferes improperly or participates improperly in the jury's deliberations on factual issues, that sort of error could be harmless.
Of course, I doubt that the government would say that except the way you worded it, which is when the district court improperly intrudes.
Yes,
that's really the question, right? Whether it's improper. So Ayani is considerably different. Ayani is a case about supplemental argument.
Correct.
There was no argument in this case. You characterize this as factual.
Yes.
So this seems different than the cases that have been described as factual, where jury asks what happened and the district court said conversation occurred on this date. In this case, at least as the government's characterizing it, that's not what this is about. This is jury asks which telephone conversations are the subject of count one. That's not the same thing as saying the conversations happened or conversations are true. It's just which conversations do we look at for the question of this particular wire count.
Yes, Your Honor, and I agree with you that the issue here is different than in Ayani. But this is a unique issue. I don't think either party found any case on point.
So why do you think the government's only going to try to argue harmless error? The government hasn't conceded that it's an error at all yet.
Absolutely. I'm sure you would agree that the government has relied heavily on harmless error throughout its brief.
Yes. Yes.
And that's why I am focusing on that, because, I mean, if the court finds that any of the issues I'm going to be addressing or that we rely on in our brief are error, any one of those issues is enough to warrant reversal if the court doesn't find that the error is harmless.
Well, let me ask you a question so I understand what happened here. The jury sent out some notes, and there are different questions in the notes, and the district court responded in different ways. But here's my hypothetical. Suppose for count one, the grand jury indicts, and the grand jury has in mind conversation number three on a certain date. But conversation number three is not identified in the indictment. Mm-hmm. How was it determined which of the conversations on the relevant date was the one that the grand jury intended?
I don't know how it could determine that.
Well, were there any grand jury notes that were submitted to the district court?
Grand jury notes?
Yes. In other words, I'm trying to understand what objective evidence there is that the grand jury, in my hypothetical, intended conversation number three, when, in my hypothetical, there were five different conversations on that day.
Right. I see where you're going, Your Honor, and I welcome that analysis. I think we probably failed to really develop that issue, but I mean that's a whole other issue here.
I thought your point was that these, at least some of the questions, required a factual response. Mm-hmm. So the fact to be responded here, arguably, is not whether a defendant did or didn't do something, mm-hmm. but rather the fact to be answered is what did the grand jury intend? And the question is, how do you answer that question?
Right.
Is there objective evidence by which to determine what it is? And I thought your argument, in part relying on Allende, was by allowing the process that happened here, it was tantamount to a supplemental argument to the jury.
Yes, we did make that argument, and I certainly adhere to that. And we also argued that if the government is correct in arguing that the court was essentially filling in blanks in the indictment, then there's a separate issue, equally serious, about whether the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to be charged by a grand jury has been violated, because the court is either changing the, in many instances it did change the indictment, that is one date was mentioned in the indictment and the court said no, that's wrong, it's a different date, at the government's behest, and in other instances, more instances I believe, the indictment was simply opaque, it did not specify which conversation was at issue.
All right, so the district court says in its opinion, denying the motion for new trial, that this was assisting the jury in understanding the indictment. He was not directing them either only to look at certain evidence as opposed to all the evidences before the jury, and indeed he instructed essentially that they were the final fact finders here. So if you have an ambiguity, I'm reading between the district court's lines, he's saying, I'm just trying to resolve that ambiguity, and it's within my discretion to do so. Mm-hmm. So how do you distinguish all those cases?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How do you distinguish those cases that where the appellate courts have acknowledged this very broad discretion that the trial court has to assist in some respects the jury?
Well, I'm simply unaware of any cases like this where a judge did anything like what the judge did in this case, so I don't know what cases you're referring to, Your Honor.
Well, the government's argument, as I understand it, is that your argument is based on a misstatement or misunderstanding of what the district court actually did, that the district court wasn't telling the jury what to find here. It was just simply answering the question that the jury had posed as to which telephone conversation was intended to go with which count in the indictment.
Right, but we, you know, on one of those days, there were 10 telephone conversations. The jury did not know which conversation was referred to in the indictment. The judge didn't know which conversation was referred to in the indictment. He simply delegated that task to the government, which then gave the judge a list. Sometimes they couldn't even find a conversation. Then they said, oh, it wasn't a conversation that was at issue. It was something else, which the jury would never have guessed from the indictment.
So if I had read every page of the transcript of the trial, mm-hmm. would I find somewhere that the actual tape recording that the jury was told referred to a specific count in the indictment was the conversation that was reviewed at trial?
Well, some of them were reviewed at trial, played, that is, the tapes were played at trial. As we pointed out in our briefs, a number of the conversations or tapes that the court directed the jury's attention to as the tape at issue here were tapes that were not played. So there was a double error with respect to those, in our view. That is, an unplayed tape was put before the jury and the court improperly told the jury, this is the tape at issue, whereas which is essentially becoming a 13th juror, sitting in the jury room, guiding the jury towards the verdict that the government desired by feeding the jury the government's view of which tapes are at issue in each count. The government clearly should have done a better job of explaining this in the indictment, clearly, or at least providing the jury with a summary chart. And the government, to its credit, learned the lesson. So in the second trial, as the court is aware, the government did not make the same mistake. They did provide a summary chart.
Let me ask you about this, just to take Judge Rogers' hypothetical and simplify it to just two calls on the same day. The account says, on or about January 1st at 6 p.m., there was a call that facilitated a drug transaction. And in fact, there are two calls that day, one's at 5, one's at 7. Mm-hmm. Both of those are on or about. If there had been only one, you wouldn't have any doubt, would you, that that call would be included within the indictment, right?
Yes, okay. I agree.
All right. So now we have two that are on or about. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why this is a question of what the jury intended. The jury says on or about that date, there was a telephone call. There are in fact two telephone calls. That gives a jury two possibilities. The jury can pick one, they can pick the other. There would be a unanimity problem if they picked one over the other, right? And in fact, the government argued that we have to tell the jury which one to focus on, otherwise there might be a unanimity problem. I don't understand why that, there's nothing about the intention of the grand jury that's relevant once the grand jury issues the indictment. The only question is, was there a telephone call on or about this date which facilitated a drug transaction? If there were two, the jury's entitled to pick either one of those, right? Isn't that right?
You mean if two are mentioned in the indictment?
If there are two that day, the jury could pick either one. It would be a legitimate verdict if the jury unanimously agreed on one of those without any guidance from anybody. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right?
So is the point that the district court should have told the jury, you have to decide which of the tapes supports which of the charges?
Right. The issue we've focused on is exactly that, Judge Rogers.
Whether the
court can tell the jury it is this one and not this one.
Well, the government has a right. Doesn't the government have a right to drop some of its evidence and some of its theories and focus on only one in order to avoid the unanimity problem? There's another way to get around the unanimity problem, which was that the judge could have given a unanimity instruction. You didn't ask for that. No one asked for that. Mm-hmm. This was an alternative way of avoiding a unanimity problem, which is the government saying, we only want you to look at this one.
Well, but I don't think the government ever articulated your honor's theory.
They did. I didn't come up with this.
It did?
Yes. This was the argument. The government's lawyer said, you have to do this, because otherwise we have a problem as to which call it was.
The government actually said we want to drop the.
No, they didn't say it that way. But what they said was, the jury needs to be told which one, mm-hmm. so the it's not, you know, there's not a risk of some of the jurors going one way and some of the jurors going the other way. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying about this is this seems, maybe I'm not saying much different than what you're saying, which is that this is an issue that we don't find a precedent for. This
absolutely.
Is, right? This is not either argument nor fact-finding.
Right. I agree with that, but we also made the point that you could look at this, what happened here is a more serious infringement on the jury's, on the rule against instructing the jury, I mean, telling the jury factual answers than in Ayeni, because in Ayeni, the court did not weigh in on one side or the other. It gave both sides an opportunity to make supplemental arguments to the jury. So it did not favor one side or the other. Here, as the record shows, the defense was essentially not given any opportunity to have input into the instructions to the answers to the jury. The court just it didn't even give the defense an opportunity to speak except to put its objections on the record. The court
enough.
Just turned to the government.
That's enough, isn't it?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
That's enough, isn't it?
That's enough, in my view, to show the unfairness and unwarrantedness of this.
No, but I mean, it's enough to alert the district court that there is an objection. That's all I'm getting at.
Oh, no, that's not enough. Because I mean, the defense was not given a chance to argue these issues. They were given a chance to make an objection, and that's it. And that was only after the court had already decided what to tell the jury, not before.
I thought there was discussion with the prosecutor and defense counsel.
And sometimes there was, but
yeah.
on many other occasions, as it got worse as things went along. In the end, the defense was not given any opportunity to.
No, but I mean, in the beginning, mm-hmm. all I'm trying to get at is there was a discussion with all parties mm-hmm. as to how to respond.
Yes,
and
in
arguably, the district court decided how he was going to proceed.
Yes.
And he didn't need to hear a new argument every time because he had already heard the argument.
Well, except that each jury asked different factual
yeah.
questions. And so, for example, the time that there were 10 conversations, that certainly warranted the defense being given an opportunity to say, well, it's not, we don't believe it's the call that the government is focused on. It could have been any one of these other three calls, and they just weren't given an adequate opportunity. And frankly, that's a problem that runs throughout the case, cutting off defense opportunities to even make a record of objections in this trial. A classic case was when Mr. Zucker was threatened with contempt for making a totally proper objection to the court's exclusion of devastating cross against the Tyrone Thomas under Rule 608B. This case is a mess, and we've only focused on the issue that evidently is the court is focused on here. But which of course it is a unique issue, and it warrants the attention.
You should go ahead and focus on anything you want. I think we're focused on this because you started with this. If you started with
another
one, you might be focused on another.
I guess looks like is my time up already?
No.
Let's go. It is the most interesting issue because it's unique. But
what's your other issue?
The with respect to the unconfronted and unredacted tapes issue, the government has a heavy burden also of showing that the errors were harmless. And I don't believe that the government carried that burden. How could it carry that burden when 100 different unplayed tapes were given to the jury during the deliberations?
Well, let's be clear. And I'll ask the government too, because I want to be clear exactly what the district court's ruling was as to what tapes are to go to the jury. And the government can correct my reading of it, because mm-hmm. it's more familiar with the record than I am. But I thought the district court had said, first of all the tapes were admitted into evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That second, the tapes that had been played at trial would go to the jury.
Correct.
And third, that the jury could ask for additional tapes.
Yes.
And indeed, the district court instructed to that effect. Now, where I'm not clear is, did the district court say that in submitting the tapes, both the played and unplayed tapes to the jury, only redacted versions of those tapes would go to the jury? In other words, at trial, some of the tapes had been played, but the prosecutor had stopped the tape. So yes. Was it the judge's understanding that when he said the played tapes are to go to the jury, it was the redacted played
tapes? Yes.
All right,
yes.
So assume all that's correct. The prosecutor sends a letter to defense counsel saying, I don't know, technologically impossible to redact.
Yes.
Does the defense want to raise this concern or objection or issue with the district court? And what did defense do?
Well, Mr. Rettoretta says that he did object to, but it doesn't appear in the transcript. That's the problem here. Mr. Rettoretta is actually in the courtroom today. You can ask him. But
well, if it doesn't appear in the record, I mean, I don't know how we can.
It doesn't
rely
appear
on
in the record, but I mean, sometimes the objections that get made don't appear in the record. He had previously made it very clear that he wanted to have the redactions done. And the government, of course, had agreed. That was common ground.
When you say it's not in the record, you mean he raised it with the district court and there was no court reporter present?
It's not clear to me what happened. I wasn't there, Your Honor, so I don't know.
So you don't know. We know that there's a letter from the government. We know that there's no responding letter. Is that right?
Correct. In my opinion, the more serious issue is not the failure to redact, but the government's admitted mistake in including 100 unplayed tapes that it had originally selected to be played at trial, but never played.
But you're representing Mr. Thomas, aren't you?
I'm representing this. Well, yes, but in this argument,
I thought Thomas's attorney told the district court he wanted all the tapes to go to the jury.
Originally,
the played and unplayed.
Yes, he did. He said that, but the court didn't. You know, the court, for whatever reason, decided that only the played, as Your Honor just said, only the played tape should be submitted to the jury.
But that then was afterwards, the court found that not to be a cause for changing the verdict. So
right.
It's the same court. Can I ask, is it the same two CDs that we're talking about? We're not talking about tapes, right? We're talking about calls.
Yes.
When you say 100 tapes, you mean 100 calls.
Right.
Are those on the same two CDs?
Yes.
So those two CDs were given to defense counsel, right?
Yes, they were, at the last minute. And Mr. Rettoretta did not have time to listen to the 255 calls on the two CDs.
When did it go back to the jury? On what day did it?
The first, I believe it went back the very first day.
The letter's dated May 25th. What's the date? Same day that it go back to the jury?
I believe so. That's a detail that I'm not 100% certain of, but I believe that's the case.
Was there a request for time to listen to the tapes or anything like that?
I think it's clear from the record there was not if there was any time to listen to the tapes, you might have listened to a few of the recordings, but there were 255 different calls on the two CDs.
No,
100 of them were mistakenly included. The government admits that was a mistake because it was not done deliberately by the government. It was a mistake. And we're not accusing the government of deliberately including these, but it's common ground that was a mistake. That was not what the court's intention was. I think it's also clear that that Mr. Retta had no time to review these before they went to the jury. So the government's argument that he failed to object is not well taken.
So what is the problem? I appreciate the violation of the judge's instruction, which the judge in the end, I guess, decided didn't matter afterwards.
He said it was harmless. As he said, all the errors were harmless.
I understand. But this is evidence that is already in the record. So what is the problem? Why is there harmful error when evidence that is in the record goes to the jury, even though the judge...
You mean because the 25,000 calls were admitted early in the trial?
Yes.
The court has repeatedly held that, as have other courts, that only played tapes...
When have we ever held that?
We cite the cases in the...
Well, you cited the Lampkin case. It's a very different case. So in Lampkin, the problem was that there was a witness on the stand, a juvenile witness who was a cooperator, and that witness also had a videotape confession. And part of the videotape confession came in during the trial, and the witness was cross-examined about it. And the remainder went to the jury by mistake, and the witness was not able to be cross-examined. So there was a confrontation problem.
Mm-hmm.
Here the witness is your client. Here the witness are the clients. Mm-hmm. They are not, that is, the people on the tape. They are not anybody who is otherwise testifying.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't have been cross-examined. Mm-hmm. So this is not a Sixth Amendment problem. I don't see there's a... You can't cross-examine a wiretap tape. You could put on your own witnesses if you wanted to, but you can't cross-examine that tape. Those witnesses aren't present to be cross-examined.
Right, but remember, all these tapes were interpreted for the jury, and that's another issue in the case, whether that was proper.
I assume the unplayed tapes weren't interpreted, so you don't have that problem.
Right, the unplayed tapes were not interpreted. But, I mean, I believe this court has held, not just in Lampkin, we cited other cases as well where the court has essentially adopted the Ninth Circuit's analysis in Islamini.
I'll give you a chance on rebuttal to tell me what the cases are, because I did want to look
okay,
at those.
I believe Cunningham is one of those cases.
Okay.
And there's a third case that we cite for the same proposition. In any event, whether or not, I believe the court has repeatedly adhered to that position. And it's the correct position, because there are all, as the Ninth Circuit has pointed out, there are all kinds of problems with submitting an unplayed tape to the jury.
I know. In many...
They say it's structural error.
I know they say that, but they don't give any reason. I read the opinion. They don't give any reason, and they, except for this confrontation argument, which doesn't strike me as really applying. So we have to decide ourselves whether this is right. So in a bank fraud case, mm-hmm. the government will often put on all the checks, right? And they will not discuss every single check. Is your position that every check has to be separately discussed before it can go back
Absolutely.
To the jury?
That would be ridiculous.
Right. So why is this different?
It's different because tapes are like testimony. You have conversations. There are matters of interpretation, completeness. Are we listening to the whole tape? One of the things the Ninth Circuit has pointed out is the danger that the jury might just listen to a snippet of the conversation and never have heard the entire conversation. So
the jury might look at one check and not at another one. This is always a problem. And when you have a case with a lot of documents, that's always a problem.
If there are hundreds of checks, no one check is going to be that critical. But with tape conversations of the defendant in this case, which are quite incriminatory, one misunderstood tape could affect the verdict.
Okay.
So I do think it's different than the bank, the check example.
Okay, thank you.
I think I'm out of time now, right?
Right.
So, thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Dennis Hart. I'm here on behalf of Frederick Miller. I'm the designated overview lawyer. I should add that
are you a lay witness here, or are you an expert witness?
I'm certainly lay. I use the word overview very generally, and I hope the court excuses me if I push everyone into that one category, because I know that there are different witnesses who testify to different things, whether they're summary witnesses or true overview witnesses or tape interpreter witnesses. They all occurred in this first trial and in the second. But as far as for expediency, I hope to use just the word overview and hope the court understands what I mean by that. And that is, I mean the testimony given by Agents Sparks, Turner, and Hall. There are two things I'd like to accomplish in my 4 minutes. The first one is to demonstrate to the court that the district court was well aware of the problem by the objections raised by the defendants. There was a motion filed even before trial began by, I believe it was the counsel for Defendant Moore. All the other defendants were permitted to adopt it, and it challenged the use of these FBI agents to interpret it. I wish I could tell the court what motion that was, but it never made it into the electronic docket. So there's no number, there's no reference on the docket to this motion. I know it took place because the government answered it. And their answer is document 616. It was filed, I believe, on the 20th of March. That was also the time that it was discussed very briefly for Judge Lambert, and he denied the motion. He permitted the government, and if you'll see from the government's response, they put forth the general theory that it could be a 701, it could be a 702, the witness could be both, and we agree with that. The problem is that the government phrased its justification for this on what I would call the coded words theory. That is, agents are allowed to testify about coded words in a tape transcript that helps the jury. This case is not a coded words case. There was not code deciphering. Oh, well, true, there were sporadic references to codes, but that is by far and away the minority of the interpretations given in this case. It is more a mind-reading objection, because that's what the agents did when they testified about the intent of the caller, about his past experience, about the hierarchy in the organization. And that leads me to another observation. It is true that the unplayed tapes were not interpreted, but the unplayed tapes did serve as a basis for the interpretation that came out, particularly from Agents Hall and Turner, who claimed that they had heard the agents, or they had heard the tapes, they interpreted them, they could tell the hierarchy of the organization from all of the tapes. So while it's true the unplayed tapes were not interpreted explicitly, they also served as a basis for the determination of Agent Turner saying, well, Mr. Miller really intended to say this, or I know Mr. Miller was going to meet them there, or I know Mr. Miller was under this person and over this person, the hierarchy of the conspiracy.
I know that you are providing an overview. That's how you've characterized it. But are you objecting to specific parts of the agent's testimony? And can you identify that?
I will, Your Honor. Agent Sparks was the first to testify. He was a true overview witness because he's the one that testified about, for instance, vouching for the informants and how they're tested by his procedures, how they're tested by the U.S. attorney, and how we know the veracity of them can be trusted because of all these backstops. That's a true overview witness, but he also later on in his trial testimony gave interpretations of the wiretaps. His first appearance was on March 21st in the AM session when he gave an overview summary. He was objected to on the basis of his knowledge, on relevance, on the characterizations of the conspiracy. All those objections were overruled by the district court. He testified later in April 24th, the AM session, in his 50 pages of testimony in which he characterized the content of those tapes. There was 9 different objections as to his opinion on those events. Agent Turner also testified. He began his testimony on March 22nd. In a little math here, in his 99 pages of testimony on March 22nd and March 23rd, there were 49 objections. They were based on his knowledge, on his opinion, on his giving characterizations of hierarchy, of content, of intent by the individuals. All of those objections, with the exception of 2, were overruled. Those 2 objections were because The government asked the compound question. The trial court sustained the objection to that, and the government got to ask the same question a different way. But all of those 49 objections were overruled by the court. We submit this clearly puts the district court on notice that there is an objection to a person coming in as a federal agent and saying, well, Mr. Miller meant this. Well, Mr. Miller did this. Mr. Miller had this in his mind when he said this. Clearly that cannot be said, but the district court allowed it despite the repeated objections. We also, there is a third agent, Agent Hall, who testified on April 4th. In his 34 pages of characterizations of the transcripts, characterizations of the tapes, those 34 pages, there were 9 objections. The same thing. He doesn't have the knowledge to do it. He doesn't have the basis to do it. He can't interpret a person's mind based on what he hears over the tapes. All of those objections were overruled. I see that my time is up. And so I'm
going to... Do you want to discuss, as your colleague anticipated, the government's response?
I don't see how they can say with a straight face that this was harmless error. And perhaps the best evidence of that is the fact that Mr. Miller was hung on all of the major counts. He was acquitted on several, 16, I think, convicted on 21. They were all telephone counts. But the major counts, the life counts, the jury hung on that. And I don't see how anyone can say there's an overwhelming case in light of the jury's decision in that regard. If there are no other questions, thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
Good morning. May it please the court. Nick Coleman for the United States. I'd like to begin, actually, if I could, with the last remark made by counsel with respect to the so-called overview testimony or agent testimony, which I think is the better term for this. It's, in fact, the fact that the jury didn't convict Mr. Miller, for example, of some of the major charges like the continuing criminal enterprise charge. It didn't convict him of every telephone count charge either. For example, there were a series of 4 calls on February 17th, all of which were charged as communications offenses, all of which, I believe it was Agent Turner, provided opinions about the meaning of the calls for. On one, Mr. Miller was acquitted, and on the three, on the other three, the jury failed to reach a verdict. And what I think this shows is the reason why it was harmless, to the extent that there was error under this court's decisions in Moore and Hampton, is that the jury didn't wholeheartedly buy the agent's interpretations. They looked critically at these charges, and they looked critically at the evidence in support of those charges. Nor did the jury wholeheartedly accept the cooperator's testimony, despite the fact that under this court's decision in Moore, the agents did provide what's now known to be erroneous testimony about how the FBI handles cooperators. Even if the jury somehow got the message that the FBI believed its cooperators and had taken whatever steps it wanted to be satisfied with their testimony, the jury obviously didn't accept all of these cooperators' testimony, or they would have convicted Miller of a lot more than they did at this trial. They failed to reach a verdict on the continued criminal enterprise charges to him, the RICO conspiracy as to him at that first trial. The only thing they convicted him on were individual communications charges.
So does this argument apply to Thomas, too?
Yes, I think it also applies to Mr. Thomas, too. He was also not convicted of every communications charge against him, even when agents provided their interpretations of those calls. There were a lot of them, so it's hard for me to list them all right now. But I think if you go charge by charge, you'll find that if you look at the corresponding agent testimony, you'll see that most of the time the agents provided an interpretation. The jury didn't convict based on all of those. I think when you look at it's much easier though to see why the jury convicted, because when you see that there were strong points of corroboration, for example, the calls relating to the shipment of the 4 kilograms from Arizona, or the calls relating with respect to Mr. Miller, the calls relating to the money seized from Mr. Brown at the airport by the DEA.
So the physical evidence.
Yes, I think when, well, both physical evidence, other calls, which put the calls into context where, you know, and where you have evidence of events going on outside, that it's easy to say, based on the chronology, look, these calls were about that in particular, you know, all of the calls between Mr. Miller and Mr. Brown about getting the money back that had been seized, things like that. It's pretty clear that the jury figured out what the basis was for the agent's belief, and they decided on their own what they believed had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's why I think, you know, to the extent and I think this also applies to something that counsel for Mr. Thomas mentioned at the beginning of his argument, and I'll proceed now to the question of the jury notes. For all of these errors, although they have said that, you know, somehow you put them together and they become structural errors, you can tie whatever errors occurred to the actual counts. You can see, if an agent testified about a communications charge, you know, even if you decided that was error, at most, that would affect that charge. And I think the same is true with respect to the notes that were provided to the jury. I think one point that should be made before we discuss whether or not those notes were error at all is that even if you see the notes, the responses of the judge to those notes as error, the effect of the error is confined to the individual charges related to those calls or the overt acts under the RICO conspiracy count that were specific to those calls, and therefore those responses don't affect the charges which the jury never asked about or overt acts never asked about.
I want to be very clear on your first argument. You're distinguishing Hampton then on the ground of the physical evidence and the events that actually happened, such as we're going to meet at a Safeway store, things like that, referenced in some of the taped recordings, and that Tyrone Thomas testified to at trial?
I think there, in general, if you look at the evidence that this court referred to in Hampton and thought was insufficient, if you compare what was going on in this trial, at least with respect to the conviction, to the actual charges that there were convictions on, there was a wealth more evidence. I'm sorry.
That's why I want to be sure I understand the government's argument. Because if you look at Hampton, this minutia argument doesn't work. But in Hampton, there wasn't all this physical evidence and the type of corroborating evidence you were discussing.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. But I think it also bears out, however, that when you look at how the jury, if the jury really was swayed by all of these interpretations, I think you would have seen a much broader
number of convictions. But I think Hampton didn't care about that, is what I'm getting at.
Well,
they just said, you know, this agent's testimony, there's no way to tell. End of discussion. And then there's this paragraph about what evidence there wasn't in that case. And I thought you were trying to contrast this case to that case.
I think it can certainly be contrasted to Hampton based on the evidence. I'm not sure that Hampton really discussed the question of looking at, the jury's verdicts, where they failed to convict.
Because they said you couldn't tell.
And I think
that's
in this case,
that's all I'm trying to get at. You may disagree with that analysis, but that's the analysis of the court. And so the question was, how do you distinguish it?
I think it can certainly be distinguished on the basis of the additional corroborating evidence. I mean, the reverse sting operation, the various consensual calls between Tyrone Thomas and especially Timothy Thomas. Those calls, I mean, that is a great deal more evidence than was at issue in Hampton, at least with respect to the charges of conviction. Looking at the actual notes themselves, I do think
Hampton. I just need to be clear about this. You're reading Hampton as even if there was no physical evidence,
no,
the corroborating
calls
I and think the jury verdicts would be sufficient here?
No. What I'm saying is that I think that there are two ways that you can find these, to the extent that there was error under Hampton in this case, you can find that error harmless. Whatever standard of review is being applied, whether we're talking about preserved error or unpreserved error, I think you can conclude, first of all, yes, with respect to the charges on which the jury convicted, The evidence against Mr. Thomas and Mr. Miller was far, far stronger than the evidence against...
The physical evidence. I'm trying to distinguish.
Yeah.
Because Hampton just took the position that, you know, this agent, he was called once, twice, three or four times, just like Sparks was here. And that did it for the court. That paragraph, and I thought that's what you were going to focus on, is saying why we shouldn't follow Hampton because of that paragraph.
Yes, and I think that is one point on which that case can be distinguished. I think there are multiple reasons why this case is distinguishable from Hampton. That is one of them. And I do think that the seizure of the drugs and the calls, and in particular the reverse the sting operation with respect to Mr. Thomas.
I thought that paragraph was written for the government. You would know how to distinguish it in the future case.
Well, and I do think, obviously, Hampton came out after the government wrote its brief in this case. That's true. And I do think that in this case, the seizure of the drugs combined with the calls, these consensual calls, which I think are, I mean, they're not physical evidence in the sense of things where you find fingerprints on them, but where you have very clearly conversations between Tyrone Thomas and Appellant Thomas, and then between Appellant Thomas and Appellant Miller and Appellant Island, those calls, which are so explicit as to what they're talking about, particularly when you match them up with the chronology of what we know about when those drugs were seized.
Okay, you had started on the judge's responses to the jury notes.
What the judge did here was not to tell the jury what evidence was relevant to a charge. In other words, in a normative sense, if this is what you should be considering as you decide guilt or innocence.
And here's what the judge said in denying the motion for new trial. He says, the government further contends that the indictment alleged dates and times of the phone calls in and on or about format, and that the jury was instructed that proof need not establish with certainty the exact date of the alleged offense. That's the way the district court understood the argument. He wasn't talking about unanimous verdicts.
Well, the government certainly saw it in those points, and the government did raise the argument that there could be a unanimity problem. I'm not sure that those two things are completely incompatible. I think the question was that the jury did want to, I mean, I think if you took, it's pretty clear the judge wanted to make sure that the jury understood which call had been charged. For the ones for which there was a typographical error
in
the indictment.
And how did he know that? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, right. And the government did identify, and he did ask the government to confirm, well, is it this call, is it not this call?
How did the government know?
That isn't disclosed on the record. Obviously, certainly the government would have had, it was the one in the grand jury, would have had an idea of what it asked the grand jury to charge.
Well, I'm very serious about this. The grand jury secrecy, I'm not trying to suggest you invade that, but I'm trying to understand how any trial judge reading the indictment where there are multiple calls on a certain day would know which call was intended as distinct from simply saying, since it's on or about, it's up to the jury to decide whether there are calls relating to that count or whether, the calls support the charge.
Right. Well, I think a court could try to determine it by looking at not simply the evidence presented to the grand jury, but what arguments and, in other words, what did the prosecutor say to the grand jury before it asked for the final vote?
The district court?
The district court, if there was a challenge, in other words, if appellants had challenged these responses not on the grounds that they did, but if instead what they had argued was what they appear to trying to be presenting now at this late stage, and they didn't raise this argument in their opening brief, but if what they had said was, this amounts to a constructive amendment of the indictment. We're not sure that the grand jury actually charged these calls as opposed to a different call.
But they object that the judge was interfering with the fact-finding role of the jury.
And I think that's a different issue. That's
I understand, I'm focusing on that.
Yeah, I don't think that was certainly at the time when the judge formulated his responses. He didn't couch them in terms of, well, it's just on or about, because that would have implied that then the jury could just make up its own mind. It could just look at it and decide what we think it's
the government's argument, says the district court in its published opinion.
That wasn't really the argument. If you look at the transcript of what we said, we thought that the
pages of your opposition.
True, but I think that the argument that we made at the time when the responses were made, the position that we had was that the jury did need to know what charge was made because there could be a unanimity problem.
So what about my hypothetical? I just need to understand the government's position on that.
And that's
my hypothetical, right. Is there are five telephone calls on a certain date, and just hypothetically, the grand jurors voted to indict on that count because of conversation number three.
Right.
But that doesn't appear anywhere in the indictment or in any document from the grand jury, so far as we know, that was available to the district court. And the prosecutor is asked to tell the judge which call was intended.
Right, which I think is the case that you have here, where, I mean, it's in the sense that because you can't match up the language of the indictment,
How do we have some objective basis for knowing that the prosecutor didn't mistakenly tell the judge it's call number two?
Well, that challenge could be raised, Your Honor, in the district court. If the defense in this case had said, how do we know? When the prosecutor says it's call X,
okay.
How do we know?
I understand
that,
you want,
then a hearing could be held.
All right, but...
But that wasn't
I get your point, so we're at plain error on that. But I just want to understand the process. When the jury says, is it call number three or is it call number two? And the judge tells them, based on what the prosecutors told them, it's call number two. That's what happened here.
Well, it
is. As distinct from the judge saying, you have to make up your mind.
Right.
Which of these five calls supports that count?
That is. It is correct that the court advised the jury as to what the government said was the correct charge call once we got to that point. I think once you assume the validity of what the prosecutor said, and no challenge was raised to the validity of what the prosecutor said, there wasn't a challenge that the prosecutor has identified the wrong call.
Okay, move beyond that.
Right. Once we get to that point, the question is, could the judge clarify for the jury so that it would consider the correct call? In other words,
Why isn't that analogous to allowing the prosecutor to argue to the jury that what was intended to support that count is call number two?
I think it's not so much allowing the prosecutor to argue it.
Well, that's
it's
the
more
only
a question
place the judge got the information.
Well, it's more in advising the jury of what the grand jury charged, so that the jury considers the correct charge.
But that's in the indictment. That's in the four corners of the indictment.
Yes. However, if the grand jury made a type, I mean, and after all, the indictment is ultimately the grand jury's indictment. If the grand jury's indictment contains a typographical error such that, and we know from the other information what the grand jury intended, the question is, should the judge tell the jury, look, this is what the grand jury indicted, that's what you should evaluate, as opposed to just guessing where you could have a unanimity problem or potentially a constructive amendment.
You're saying this is tantamount to a typographical error?
I think ultimately that's really what it boils down to.
If the indictment had said call number three, but it really should have been call number two, that would be a typographical error. The jury says, which call is it, two or three?
Yes, correct.
How is that a typographical error?
I guess you're saying some of them, the AM and PMs are typographical.
Yes, I mean, there are AM and PMs. I think sometimes the minutes are off.
No, but I'm in my hypotheticals, understand the government's position.
I think having accidentally, you know, just somebody accidentally puts three as opposed to two, particularly if you could tell
but
from the record.
But there's nothing. The only place we're getting this is from the government.
Well, that's true. And again, if the government had no basis for what it said, a challenge could be raised to that, and then you would go back to the transcripts of the grand jury's proceedings.
My only point
to decide,
is if the grand jury asks, is it call number two or call number three, why isn't that a question of fact for the grand jury to figure out? That's all I want to know.
The grand jury or the trial jury? I'm not sure. I'm sorry. the...
I'm saying the jury sends a note to the district court trial judge saying, for this count, is it call number two or call number three?
Yes.
And why isn't the answer to that question, it's for you to figure out?
I think the problem comes then, if the jury, taking your Honor's hypothetical, if we knew that the grand jury indicted for call two and not call three, but then we tell the jury it's for you to figure out, and the jury decides, well, it could be two, it could be three, we'll convict on the basis of whichever one we think, then you have at that point amended the indictment. The jury has now convicted the defendant of a charge for which he was not indicted. And I think that was how the court saw its responses. And I think that, I agree, there isn't much precedent for this out there. Seen in that light, I don't think that if it's known what the correct charge was, that it's necessarily error.
See, in the judge's opinion, he's very careful in his phraseology, and he doesn't suggest that he's telling the jury, the Pettit jury, what the grand jury intended.
The opinion that Your Honor is referring to was written significantly after the time when these decisions were made. I think if you look at when the decision was made, if you look at the transcript of when these were provided and how the government saw it, the defense saw it, and the judge saw it at that time,
the judge said
I was trying to help clear up in a case this complex, I believe is what he said from the bench. In a case of this complex, I'm not going to just leave the jury to its own devices here. And the government certainly argued that this was a potential unanimity problem. In other words, trying to make sure that the jury actually considered the correct charge.
I just want to understand, does the government adopt the district court's analysis here where he says it's okay for him to, or it's within his discretion, for him to supply the jury a recorded phone call or inform the jury that they, in fact, already have the call or where they can find it amidst the 24,000 recorded calls available? That's the way the judge characterizes. Yes.
I think if we certainly adopt that to the extent that if what he's saying is if you're directing them to make sure that they understand what is the charge to call among the ones that they have in front of them, that's all he's doing. He's not telling them how to evaluate that call. Mm-hmm. He's not telling them what other things they could look at. And one thing I think is, appellants have argued in their brief that it was tantamount to saying that they shouldn't listen to any other call. I don't think that's actually true. They could have listened to any other call they wanted to put it into context. But the question was that call a criminal act or was it not?
The judge says, I merely confirmed or identified the existence and location of recorded calls.
Right, and I think to the extent that in order in the service of identifying what was the charged call, I think that's how, because otherwise what he's saying is I don't read him as saying I was identifying for them the relevant evidence.
No, I agree.
So I think he is saying that he was identifying the correct charge.
See, I just wanted to be clear because I read the government's brief to say that the defense had just misunderstood what the district court did. So then I went to the district court's published opinion in denying the motion for a new trial to understand upon reflection after Allende how the district court saw what it did. And he's very careful. All right, so the language here is consistent with the type of discretion that district court judges have exercised. And my concern is in the context of this case, in a sense, is that an accurate reflection of what happened here when the jury says, is it call two or call three?
I definitely think that if you look at what the jury was asking, the jury was asking for a certain charge, what was the charged call? Or for a specific overt act, what is the call at issue? And certainly the jury would have seen the judge's responses as identifying for them, this is the charged call. So I think looking at the record, as a whole, as to how the jury would have understood it, they saw it as clarifying for them what the charge was. This court has not specifically held that that's error. This is an unusual situation, obviously, where, preferably, of course, an indictment doesn't contain typographical errors, but when it does, we think that this was within the judge's discretion. Even if not, at most, it would affect the specific charges and specific overt acts. And if you take those away, you are still left with, the unaffected convictions are not. There's no reason to think that these responses.
Can I ask you a different hypothetical about this? Because I have to say I'm conceptualizing this quite differently. Imagine that the indictment says the defendant is guilty of using and carrying a firearm in connection with a drug crime, and the evidence shows two firearms. And the jury says, which firearm? And the government says, look, we don't want a risk here of a unanimity problem, so we're going to drop one of the firearms. We're going to say machine gun, not the semi-automatic, or the Ruger, not the Smith & Wesson. Isn't that what we have here? You wouldn't go back and call up the grand jurors and ask them, which gun did you think you were charging? Instead, the grand jury had several different guns, any one of which might have been sufficient, and the government is just dropping one of the possible pieces of evidence in order to avoid a unanimity problem. Why isn't that what's happening? I have to say, that's how I read.
But the assumption there in the question, assuming either gun was sufficient.
Right. The difference, I think, is this, Your Honor, that in Your Honor's hypothetical, as I understand it, the grand jury, in other words, we don't think that the grand jury distinguished between the two. If we don't think that that was the case, then if there's a question of unanimity for the trial jury, and we don't want to run the risk that they wouldn't agree as to which gun it was, then yes, the government could drop it that way. In this case, in all honesty, I think the government clearly thought that there was a specific charged call.
I understand that, but I don't think the government, the question is, what did the grand jury actually, which gun, or in any other example, where that mattered? It may be that you knew which one the grand jury intended. I understand that, but I don't know why that matters, and I don't know of any case where that's ever mattered. Well, we've gone back to look at what the grand jury actually thought in order to decide which of two different theories embedded in the indictment could go forward.
I think the problem is there's a distinction between when the grand jury approaches, if you could have multiple theories of reaching a conviction as opposed to
any case where this kind of questioning of what did the grand jury act. I'm not talking about in the context of a jury note. I'm talking about, some case where somebody was found guilty on call number one. He says, well, that's not the one the grand jury thought about. Has that ever been an issue before?
I'm not aware that, I don't think that a case like this has arisen, Your Honor. I have not found one. So
we should look at this in terms of the government had five calls on that day, any one of which would have been sufficient. And when the jury's asking us, is it call two or three, just for unanimity purposes, we'll tell them it's call two.
I don't think that I can fairly characterize this as that case, because the government clearly thought that there was only one call at issue, not that there could have been five. So I don't think that I can characterize it in that way. I do think, however, that because the effect on the jury ultimately is the same, that if it's appropriate for the government to, say, drop a charge and have them only consider one, and for the judge to convey that to the jury, that, you know, from the jury's point of view, all that they want to know is, what is the call that I'm supposed to evaluate and decide guilt or innocence? And that's what the judge did here. Regardless of whether we think it's a question of whether the grand jury charge, or regardless of whether we think purely as the grand jury might have had multiple things in mind, but we want to make sure this jury only has one, either way the effect is the same. And that's why I don't think that these notes were error in this case.
It's not the notes were error. It's the question of the response.
I'm sorry, the response is what I'm thinking of the judge's notes to the jury in response. Turning to the, since I just have a minute and a half
so
left, to the question.
So could you just review for me just once more what you just summarized?
I think that if you look at it from the jury's point of view, of it wants to know what should it consider. Regardless of whether the reason why the judge answers that question is because the prosecution wants to avoid the jury not being able to agree on a single crime, or whether it's a concern that, you know, we want to make sure that the jury only considers the charges that the grand jury indicted on, that the trial jury considers the one. Either way, the judge's response is going to be the same, and the question is that error? And I think, for the jury, does that intrude on the jury's deliberating process? And it doesn't, because what it is telling them this is what you should be deliberating about, not how should you evaluate the evidence. With respect to the question of the unplayed and unredacted tapes, I think, the issues to keep at the forefront here are that these tapes were in evidence, and they didn't represent a confrontation clause problem because this isn't the question of somebody's testimony or statements to the government that have been conveyed to the jury without cross-examination. These were items in evidence, and it is appropriate for evidence to be submitted to a jury without all of it having been displayed or played at trial. That being said, it is unfortunate here that the additional calls were apparently submitted. Appellants have only identified 8 of them in their brief, and only one of them, as far as I can tell, resulted in a communications charge conviction. The remaining calls, almost all of these calls that they've identified, I think one related to the to one of the transactions involving Mr. Brown, but the remainder were simply additional calls surrounding the shipment of the 4 kilograms of cocaine from Arizona that ultimately resulted in the reverse sting. So, I think even if one were to view this as error, it was certainly harmless because the evidence with respect to those shipments was overwhelming. The reverse sting made it very clear that Appellant Thomas was involved and was trying to receive the shipment of that cocaine. The question of the redaction and the failure to redact, a letter was given to Mr. Rader-Rada. In the letter, the prosecutor said that he had advised previously Mr. Rader-Rada about that. There is no record here of an objection until June 1st, almost a week later, when all that Thomas's counsel does is file a motion that just generally says, I renew my request to have things redacted. Well, by that time, the jury had had these things for a week, and there was never a request to say, well, if there was an unredacted call for the judge to take a remedial action or any specific complaint at that point. So I'm not even sure.
Do you agree that there was a violation of the district court's order, but that the defense was on notice of it and did not timely object?
Well, two things. With respect to the 100 calls, there was obviously the judge and the parties had agreed that the calls that are initially going to go to the jury are the ones that were played in court. The fact that these 100 were included appears to be an error. And, we're not seeing that the defense necessarily should have stayed up all night listening to every one to make sure that every single one was played. So there was an error there. But, again, I think The submission of those calls, which were in evidence, there was error there, but that was harmless. The question of the redactions that Mr. Thomas has complained about were with respect to calls that were played in court, but the problem was that the material that he found objectionable was not redacted. But that, with respect, yes, there, the record does indicate that Mr. Thomas's counsel was on notice, but he didn't take any action whatsoever for a full week, and then even then it wasn't very specific to these calls or the material that he now says was objectionable.
So I just need to be clear on the record, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I thought the judge had ruled that the played tapes would go to the jury.
Yes.
That the jury could ask for additional tapes, but that the defense would have an opportunity to raise objections and seek redactions. And it's a little fuzzy here whether the judge says the parties work this out, or whether if the parties couldn't work it out, they were to come back to the judge, and then the judge would rule whether there would be a redaction. But the way I was reading the record, I thought the judge had in his mind this notion that there were defense objections, that what he was saying was send the tapes to the jury as the played tapes as redacted, and I'll basically do the same thing for the unplayed tapes after if I hear there's a defense objection and I agree with it.
I think that's a fair characterization of what the judge had envisioned was going to happen. Mm-hmm. One thing to note, appellants have not identified anything in the unplayed calls, the 100 unplayed mm-hmm. calls, that they said should have been redacted. Mm-hmm. They haven't said anything. I'm not aware of any place where they said that there was something objectionable that should have been redacted from those unplayed calls. The only thing that appellant Thomas has raised on appeal is that he says there was objectionable material in two of the played calls.
Right.
And with respect to that, they were on notice that for a technical reason that, unfortunately, I don't know the answer to, but from the record, it's not clear why, but for whatever reason, he was notified before the discs went back, and apparently was notified orally, because that's what the letter says, was that as Mr. Rigoretta has
so, advised. So I guess my point is it your understanding of the record that the judge had basically delegated this to the parties to work it out as distinct from saying, here's my ruling as to how the tapes get to the jury, so that when the two discs went to the jury, in fact, that was a violation of the judge's order?
I'm not sure that I can say that this was entirely delegated in that manner, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that I can fairly say that. I do think that, however, that when this technical problem arose, that technical problem was raised. But no, there is no record of any specific objection being raised at that point.
But not raised with the district court.
Not raised with the district
yeah.
court, and I'm not aware of anything that was said, although obviously Mr. Thomas's appellate counsel indicates that something was said.
So when CDs went to the jury and the jury was instructed, was the district court instructing on the assumption that the tapes the jury had were the redacted played tapes?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, because I don't know if the judge had the letter from the government in front of it. In other words, I don't know.
That he knew.
Yeah, I can't say that there's an affirmative indication that the prosecutor said up in court, and by the way, just so the court's aware, as I told counsel, I couldn't redact the played calls. I don't know that that has been, I don't know that I can find that in the records, and I don't see it there. Nevertheless, I do think that even given the overwhelming evidence against appellant Thomas, and leading up to this reverse sting operation and including it, I don't think that any objectionable material in there could have been anything other than harmless error. If there are no further questions, we respectfully submit that the judgment of the district court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Smith, have any time left? I'll give you another couple minutes, Mr. Smith.
Yes. I thank you, Your Honor. I first want to take the opportunity to again cite you to the Cunningham decision at 140.
I'm surprised you're still citing Cunningham because you argued to me that Cunningham, that the Ninth Circuit's Neufschar case had a very good argument about structural error. I said to you, well, it didn't persuade me. Not Harry Cunningham, it turns out, didn't persuade the D.C. Circuit. Cunningham says, Barron contends that the inadvertent submission to the jury of the unredacted tapes is a structural error by an automatic reversal relying on U.S. versus Neufschar, Ninth Circuit. We disagree.
We disagree on the facts of this case.
The type of error at issue here can be, quote, quantitatively assessed in the context of the evidence presented in order to determine whether an admission was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, close quote.
In other words, we rejected the structural error approach of the Ninth Circuit.
But Cunningham also says, and I quote, our holding is not inconsistent with those of the Ninth Circuit. And we quoted that in our reply brief at page 33. The Ninth Circuit distinguished between two types of cases, one where the defendant is testifying on the recording, not testifying, where he's speaking, and there are numerous such recordings. They said that's structural error. And they distinguished that from a case where a non-testifying person was on the tape, and it was only one tape rather than numerous tapes. And then Cunningham says our holding is not inconsistent with those of the Ninth Circuit, plural, those. But I was citing Cunningham simply for the proposition that the D.C. Circuit agrees that an unplayed tape may not be given to the jury during deliberations. And the government, by the way, does not disagree about that.
Well, it's a question of whether it constitutes automatic error or not.
Yes.
And just to continue on the section that you're reading from, it says that Cunningham was limited later in Islamania. And in that case, the court says the problem was that the brother's comments, not the defendant, but the brother's comments had gone back to the jury, and the brother wasn't subject to cross.
Right.
And in Cunningham itself, it was a 911 call, and the 911 caller was not subject to cross. But that has nothing to do with whether it's played or unplayed. This has to do with whether or not there's an opportunity for cross-examination. And I still don't see what opportunity for cross-examination are you losing here from tapes involving telephone calls of the defendants?
I'm not suggesting
you would have put them on if only you had known that the tapes would have gone back.
Somebody is always introducing a tape that is played before the jury, there's always a supporting witness, and whoever that witness was, it could have even been a defense witness when the defense is introducing the tapes, each side would have an opportunity to question that witness and to present other evidence about the meaning of the tape.
Well, you certainly had an opportunity to present other evidence because it was put into evidence. The witness the government would have put on was the very witness you think the government should not have been permitted to put on. That is, it would have put on these agents who are testifying about the meaning,
right,
which we've held is inappropriate.
Right.
So here you have the benefit of not having that inappropriate testimony. Vague and ambiguous tapes that went back, none of which you've actually described to us as being a problem.
Well, we did describe a number of them as being a problem.
Of the unplayed tapes? Which parts of those would you have redacted? You haven't described an unplayed tape, portion of which you would want it redacted. Which one was that?
It's in our opening brief, and we spent quite a few pages. The government went through this in its argument. There are six or eight of the unplayed tapes that we discussed, the prejudice, which is at, it begins at page 93 of our opening brief and goes on through, quite a lot of space on that. It goes through page 106. So we have 13 pages of discussion of the prejudice from the unplayed tapes.
That's a different question. I'm sorry. I think I misspoke, which was, which ones would you have said should have been redacted? I understand the instruction was not that the unplayed tapes couldn't go back to the jury, but that they would have to be redacted, right? For prejudicial sections, right? Not I mean, the examples you give here are not ones of improper prejudice in the sense of something unrelated to the case or violence or something like that.
No, but the judge said only the play tape should go back to the jury.
In order to give an opportunity for redaction? I thought that was that's what I took. Maybe I'm wrong. I took from the colloquy between Judge Rogers and the government that the judge's instruction with respect to the unplayed tapes was they could go back subject to the opportunity of the defense to redact some of them.
No, that was not the judge's instruction. The judge's instruction was only the played tapes would go back. And he further said if the jury wants to see the unplayed tapes, which would not go back, unless the jury specifically asked for a particular tape, at which point the parties would have the opportunity to suggest redactions before that unplayed tape went back to the jury.
But wasn't
the jury never requested an unplayed tape.
I understand, but wasn't the reason, I thought that given that your client wanted all the unplayed tapes to go back, and one of the other lawyers did not want them because he wanted the opportunity to redact where necessary. Mm-hmm. The judge said, I'm not going to just send them all back. I'm going to provide an opportunity for redacting. And the way I'm going to provide it is by making the jury ask and then...
Yes, I think that's an accurate representation, Your Honor. Cunningham does stand for the proposition to me that it is the rule is you do not send unplayed tapes back to the jury. I don't know how else to interpret its statement that our ruling is not inconsistent with those of the Ninth Circuit. And the government has not argued that that this court has never decided the issue, which is what Your Honor suggested when I began my colloquy. So they apparently interpret Cunningham the same way I do, at least as far as that goes. I want to take this opportunity to really adopt, many of Judge Rogers' points here. I mean, I want to make that clear. I think Judge Rogers has raised a number of
concerns.
You've raised a number of concerns, which I don't think were either they weren't articulated at all in our briefs, or they weren't developed to the extent as sharply as Judge Rogers did in the oral argument. And I want to express our strong agreement with those concerns. I just want to quote this. I can on the issue of harmless error. I had a lot more to say, which I didn't have time to get to. But I just have to quote Agent Sparks' testimony. He's the case agent, and he says, and this is in our reply brief page 44. No, it's at page. It's at page 38 to 45. I don't have the exact page. But anyhow, Agent Sparks on March 22nd, 06 a.m. at page 56, he said, if all you're doing is hearing the wiretap calls, you don't have any real evidence. I would ask the court to read that statement at least 10 times because it's very critical to the whole harmless error issue. The government's whole argument is, look at these tapes in the cold isolation of appellate review. And with the interpretation that the government's agents put on them, look at these tapes. They're extremely incriminating. And I would admit that they are, looked at from an appellate judge's point of view. But look at Agent Sparks' testimony. If all you're doing is listening to the tapes by themselves, you don't have any real evidence. That's an incredible statement for the case agent to make. He makes it, of course, in a self-serving way. He's explaining why the agents need to put their spin on the testimony. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot of truth to what he said. so that the, you know, if you look at the evidence from the jury's perspective rather than from the perspective of, you know, a judge reading, an appellate judge reading the tape, the transcripts of the tapes, it really wasn't that strong a case. And after all, the proof is in the pudding. Defendant Miller was only convicted on several telephone counts. The defendant Moore was completely acquitted on everything, and the jury only found one object of the of this broad conspiracy that the government alleged, namely the cocaine object. So, you know, clearly this jury wasn't particularly inclined to convict. And I, you know, from that perspective, all of these very serious errors, whichever you agree, I mean, some, the government has admitted some of these things were errors, the admission of the unplayed tapes, for example. I mean, I didn't even get into Melvin Weider's testimony. Melvin Weider's testimony was incredibly prejudicial.
It's not part of the rebuttal. It wasn't raised in the previous argument of the government. So.
Oh, right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I didn't get to it.
And we're 10 minutes over. So if
you have any prepared remarks.
If you have any more that's immediately responsive, or if the judges have any questions.
Well, only to say that I do think that the, in summing up, that the errors, if they are errors, are quite prejudicial. Each one is quite prejudicial. When you add them all up cumulatively, there's tremendous prejudice. And this case was much more of a horse race, as the verdicts show, than you might imagine from just reading the transcripts of the most incriminating tapes. And so looked at from the jury's perspective and the act, what actually went on in the trial, I don't think that the government can prevail on its harmless error arguments.
Thank you. Mr. Hart, have any time left? So you won't feel bad about not having had as much time as everybody else. We'll give you another minute as well.
Thank you. Harmlessness. In the context of Mr. Miller, I don't think the government could ever meet, in its truncated analysis that the court just heard, could ever meet its harmless error burden. But I think the best rebuttal for harmlessness for the agent testimony, if we call it that, comes from Agent Turner. March 23rd, a.m., page 29, questioned by the government. So what were you thinking? This is in relation to a tape that they had just played. So what were you thinking? I was thinking it was about drugs or money. Question by the government. What about the reference where Mr. Brown says, okay, we can do the first thing, the same thing, like everything? Answer by Agent Turner. The same thing like everything tells me that he's done it before. Objection, overruled. I can't think that's a low light or a highlight, depending on your position. And this wasn't the only one. There were dozens upon dozens of other examples of where this occurred, where you can't limit it to a specific call that he was acquitted or convicted of. It goes to the character of the defendants and the interpretation of the agents. Thank you.
Thank you. I will take the case under submission. Mr. Smith and Mr. Hart, you are appointed by the court. We greatly appreciate your representation. We'll take a brief break before the second trial case begins. Thank you.
It's okay to put my stuff up here?
Yeah, it's fine. If you want to adjust the lectern, you can use it.
Like any more height?
Stand, please.
morning. Eric Kirschbaum on behalf of Gerald Island. Now, I'm going to argue the issue regarding the wiretaps, that it's our position that the wiretap applications in this case didn't fulfill the necessity requirement, nor were they a full and complete statement as necessary under the law to justify the use of wiretaps. Now, the court is supposed to review the wiretap applications in a common-sense, practical fashion, and that just wasn't done with the applications in this case. To begin with, the government sets forth in the initial application in February or March that they have certain cooperators, and they list what they've done, but they don't give the court any information as to the numbers assigned, 1, 4, 8, or 9. Now, the government thought enough to assign numbers to these people, or something happened to these numbers. We don't know. The court doesn't know. So if the government's missing numbers, and they otherwise appear, shouldn't the court be advised of what that is, or shouldn't the court inquire as to what about these other numbers? What happened with them? Then we go on to CW5, Victoria Owens, the individual that Frederick Miller lived with, and that Gerald Island would visit on a daily basis, more or less, up until the police presence and the government knew their presence drove him away from that house, because that was part of what was in their affidavit, that he would visit Victoria Owens' house. We know it's CW5's house, Victoria Owens' house. We know that now. And that drove him away. But we also have what's interesting, and what I think one of the more important points is that the government in the initial wiretap application says that Victoria Owens, CW5's information has been corroborated during the covert portion of the case. Now, by using, and that had to have been using traditional investigative methods because they didn't have the wiretaps yet. But the government in its affidavit doesn't disclose to the court what information had been provided by Victoria and CW5 that had been corroborated, or how it had been able to do so using traditional investigative techniques. And we have to keep in mind that Victoria Owens was at the heart of this alleged conspiracy. This is what the government described it as Frederick Miller, Gerald Island believed to be a safe house, the house they were in. And yet the government could come to the court and say, we can corroborate what Victoria Owens is telling us using these traditional methods. And she's right there in the heart of this conspiracy, alleged conspiracy. She's right there. That's where it's supposed to be taking place.
I'm not sure I'm understanding your argument. Some points in your brief, your argument is you don't need wiretaps because they got all these CWs. Now your argument seems to be CWs aren't reliable.
The argument is that the government has said, because the part is supposed to be necessity, that using traditional investigative methods, they cannot penetrate this alleged conspiracy. Yet what we have is that Victoria Owens' information, the government is saying they can cooperate it using traditional investigative techniques.
So is your argument that all they needed was Owens and therefore they didn't need a wiretap? Is that your argument?
Not in the whole, but
that
what
can't
I'm...
That can't be your argument because you think she's unreliable.
What I argue there is the government has to support her reliability in this case to justify the probable cause, because they have this prior history of her being unreliable.
So this doesn't go to the necessity argument, then?
This goes to the full and complete disclosure and the necessity argument. Because if the government can cooperate, because whether or not Victoria Owens is reliable, the government is saying we've corroborated what she says. So whether independent of Victoria Owens, how she's truthful on other matters, the government's saying, we corroborate it. So we know she's telling us the truth on what she's telling us here because we can verify it using investigative techniques traditionally. The point of necessity is that the government's saying that traditional investigative techniques are failing. And because they're failing or not working in this case, we have to go now and resort to this extraordinary method of wiretaps. But how can they make that argument when they're saying they can corroborate what Victoria Owens is saying using traditional investigative techniques? Now, Victoria Owens is not a peripheral character in this because...
Well, but Sparks, doesn't he indicate she can't provide information about certain things, that she cannot provide information about certain things that are important to the government to prove its case of conspiracy.
But does he tell us what they are? Does he tell the court?
Yeah, I thought he said she doesn't know where the stashes are and things like that. I thought he went into some detail about what she didn't know, and that's why they needed these wiretaps.
But what they don't tell us is how they corroborate what she does know. How can they have a necessity argument without telling the court? How can the court make a practical, common sense determination as to the failure of traditional investigative techniques without knowing what they're corroborating and how they're doing it? Maybe if because
I thought, but what I guess I thought Sparks was saying is that he didn't say it this way, but assume she's a perfectly good witness, but her knowledge is limited.
But we're not told exactly how what they've asked her to provide. It doesn't say we've asked Victoria Owens where this is, and she doesn't know. Mm-hmm. That's not in anything.
Do you have a case in which courts held that they have to tell exactly how it's been corroborated?
No, because
what's the closest case you have in a court of appeals?
As I see the laws, the circuit has said that these cases, these wiretap applications, have to be viewed in a practical, common sense manner. So it would seem that there is very case specific. That's why the court has this broad interpretation.
So do you have a specific case in
mind? I don't have a specific case on this point. However, it has to all be taken in consideration as to a full and complete statement.
In consideration of what? So the Ninth Circuit's view is necessity has to be measured against winning at trial. That is, against proving beyond a reasonable doubt. If that's the case, and given the defense attack here on the credibility of the witnesses, of the cooperating witnesses, doesn't it seem that in order to get beyond a reasonable doubt, the government, again, on abuse of discretion review, it's not wrong to say they needed a wiretap?
Well, then in what case wouldn't they need a wiretap? Because the defense is always going to attack cooperating witnesses. I mean, that's what the defense has to do. So then the government could always argue, well, the defense is going to attack the cooperating witnesses, so we need a wiretap. So, I mean, it seems to be that would just follow if because that's the defense, what the defense has to do. So why wouldn't it always be necessary? I mean, the government can always say it's necessary. That's why the court has to look at it in this practical, common sense fashion, looking at the facts of this case. Now, this case is different. We also have these phone calls from Miller's phone the government describes as a trusted few. Now, there are 3,000, if the court's aware of the, but how the government characterized it is, if you wanted to get hold of Frederick Miller, what you had to do is you would call him on his pager, and then he would call you back if you were one of the trusted few he would talk to. That's the average way he would deal with people. They would call him on his pager. He would call them back, blocking his number so the people wouldn't know the number that he's calling from. Then the government says that they're a trusted few that have his cell phone number, and that's where he would get these incoming calls. And because the government's trying to say, well, we're having trouble penetrating this because they deal with so few people. So that's why it's hard to get information here. That's how the government is arguing this in support of their necessity. However, there are 3,000 phone calls. I believe it's 3,000. 3,813 phone calls received by Miller from what the government has described as a trusted few people, and the court is not provided any information as to who these people are. Where are these numbers coming from? I mean, that seems to be an abuse that there are 3,000 calls. I mean, who are these people? Who are these trusted few? That's the government's words. That's not the defense coming up describing these people as a trusted few. The government has chosen to describe them as a trusted few. The government has tried to show that they're very difficult to penetrate, this conspiracy, because they deal with so few people. Yet we have the safe house, the alleged safe house the government is in because they have Victoria Owens. We have the phone calls. We have all these phone numbers that are pouring in, the 3,000 that are coming into Frederick Miller. Courts provided no information. And the court also points, in its decision supporting this, is that they had to use the wiretap because this investigation had to proceed covertly. Yet on July 10th, before the first wiretap of the year prior year, they had raided, the government had raided Victoria Owens' home. They arrested Victoria Owens. And apparently, this didn't stop Miller or Island from coming to that house. This didn't stop them trusting Victoria Owens. And obviously, if the whole point of one of the necessity arguments is that having, well, the government says they could not do physical surveillance because the neighborhood, this was a small area where this conspiracy allegedly operated, four blocks, that the members of it would notice strange people, strange cars in the neighborhood. Yet, in the same document, they raid Victoria Owens' house, and it doesn't stop anything, apparently. So how genuine is the claim that this alleged conspiracy will notice strange people when the police are kicking in the door of the alleged safe house?
Was it kicking in the door in the application?
Yes, I believe it is.
So the judge knew about it. So the judge was able to evaluate the precise argument you're making.
Yeah, but that's why it's an abuse of discretion to have...
So it's not a failure of the application, it's the district court abuse of its discretion.
That's correct. It's an abuse of discretion that if the government's supporting its position by saying, well, they will see what's going, people, they can't surveil, and the very place is being raided, how is that a valid reason to justify
it? I want to let you keep talking, but I just want to know whether you have another argument besides the wiretap, because if you do, you'll run out of time.
Mr. Hart, I believe.
We'll make the other ones. All right, go right ahead.
Okay. Then we also have in the extension of the wiretap application, in the first one, the government states that Miller is using payphones. He's not, what he does is he goes to payphones. And the government states in that extension that because Miller is using payphones, that's evidence that he's engaged in that illegal activity, because the government states in the affidavit, had it been legitimate calls, he would have used the cell phone. So his very use of the payphone leads the government to believe that he's engaged in criminal activity, yet the standard is they have to show that there's probable cause to believe that the device, the phone he's using, is going to be used. There has to be probable cause that it's going to be used in furtherance of the commission of these offenses, but the government states in its affidavit that he's not doing it on these. So, they defeat their own probable cause argument when they state that his very use of the payphones means that he's engaged in illegal activity, because if he weren't, then he would talk on the cell phone. So, I think that defeats the government's claim of probable cause once they have the first wiretap. And then they argue that, well, he still must be doing it. That's why we can't advance this investigation. And also, the government doesn't set forth. They just say, we have investigative goals. The investigative goals aren't being met. But nowhere is the court appraised, other than this general laundry list that they set forth, as to what goals are being met. Because they say, in the extension, they say these goals have been partially met. But they don't tell the court what they mean by partially met. They don't say how they're being partially met. They don't say that they're being partially met by the use of the wiretaps. So it's at some point the court has to review it and look back at the probable cause determination, and the government should have to be required to set forth, okay, we have these goals, that this wiretap has resulted in this information, and this is how it's fulfilling the goals of the investigation.
How long was the wire up for?
The wire was up, the first one was up for
30 days.
The first thing, and then it was renewed five times, and then they went to get for Mr. Miller's. They got two for Mr. Miller. So I believe it was like 7 or 8 months total of wiretap. And each time the applications are just that some of the goals have been met, but not all, but they never specify what they are. And that should be required in these wiretap application, is they say, how is the wiretap furthering this investigation? What the goals, here are the goals of the investigation, here's how the information we've gotten, and here's what we've gotten from the wiretap. So the court has a basis to form an opinion as to the value of the wiretap, that it actually is furthering the investigation, not just invading someone's privacy. I mean, that, I think, is what's required. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Hart?
Thank you, Your Honor. If I say some of the same things, I'll watch out for the hook to take me off stage. But I'm going to address overview in the second trial, also Mr. Miller's contention of masking in the wiretap argument, and his right to counsel argument that we made as an individual. In trial two, we have a new agent as the overall summary witness, Agent Bevington. He should be familiar from Hampton. We have a second agent, Agent Hall, who also testified in the first trial. Agent Bevington, as the summary witness, did such things as vouch for witnesses and described to the jury once again how he vets them, how the government vets them, and how these cooperators, who they will, the jury will see later, are trusted by the U.S. government. He engages in a sort of pre-rehabilitation, because as we know, as cooperators come to trial, defense lawyers attack them for their motives and biases. But Agent Bevington is there quite explicitly to pre-rehabilitate these people, and that is not a tactic that ought to be permitted by this court. Now, he's just a summary overall witness. The witness who did most of the opinion testimony on the tape transcripts is Stephen Hall. I have by Stephen Hall's name a 701 question mark or a 702 question mark, because I don't know which one he would be. He was an agent, but he's never been qualified as an agent. That is, we don't know what he did as far as experience, his training.
He's never been qualified as an expert, you mean?
Well, that's true. He's never been qualified as an expert.
He's not a qualified agent?
No. He's never been qualified as a person who can testify under 701 or 702. Now, as I read this court's case, I think they work on the principle that if a witness testifies from his own experience on the case, then he's a 702. If he testifies from his own experience, he's a 701. If he testifies from outside experience, he's a 702. So I applied that to Agent Hall and still cannot get an answer because he didn't listen to all the tapes, and he admits that in October 4th. He says he relied on Agent Turner for much of what he's now claiming to testify as interpretations of the wiretap intercepts. On October 4th, he also concluded that the defendants were working together to distribute drugs. That was his statement. Objection, overruled.
Can you tell me what that is?
That's page 85. October 4th. And that's in connection with his introduction of this conspiracy theory. The following day, on October 5th, despite the objection by, I believe, Mr. Island's trial counsel that this was a Crawford hearsay problem, despite that, he told the jury of the significance of the use of landline. This wasn't a code word. This was an interpretation of this call and why it was important to the government's case. That's page 74. On page 77, he was asked questions that started out with the government asking, using this phrase, "What do you believe is going on in this call?" And that's repeated half a dozen times. Page 77, page 78, page 79, page 82. Page 79, he also explains to the jury the difference between a cell phone and a landline. Whether that's required to explain to a jury, I have no idea, but it was objected to and admitted by the district court as probably 701 evidence. Perhaps the most egregious thing that Mr. Hall does is the following session, which is the afternoon session on October 5th.
I'm sorry, it's not your fault, but the way in which these appendices are arranged, where the governments have no JA numbers, I beg the government in the future to please paginate your appendices.
And put tabs in.
Or at least put tabs if you're referring to tabs.
Real tabs, not
yeah.
page tabs.
Machines don't like tabs.
I understand. But so which volume of which appendix are you referring to? Because I'm just not finding the pages.
But that's my fault if I can't direct the court to that. Okay. And I can't without my appendix here with me. All I can tell the court is it's October 5th. I believe it's the AM session.
And when you say page 85, you mean the appendix page? Or
the,
you mean
oh,
the
I'm sorry. No, the
page?
Transcript page. I'm sorry.
But you don't. And you don't know the appendix page.
The transcript page 85 for October 4th.
I see. Okay.
The following day, October 5th, transcript pages 71 through, it looks like, 82.
Okay.
That's October 4th, 5th a.m. And October 5th p.m., Hall takes the stand, and his first question is, Agent Hall, could you please summarize the prior calls that you heard? And he just goes off. That's not the sort of testimony that ought to be allowed to convict a person. I had a number of quotations from Agent Hall, but because of time, I'm going to let the court find those. Because I want to go to...
Risky business.
I'm confident that the court will get just as mad about this as I did. I want to go to wiretap, and that is Mr. Miller's argument about masking. That is masking the identity of CW5 Victoria Owens. I believe that all parties agree that Victoria Owens, CW5, is a critical central witness. Even the district court agreed with that. I believe we all now agree that the identity of Victoria Owens was masked. That is a secret, hidden...
Masked from, not from the...
Not from the authorizing judge.
Correct.
But from the reviewing judges and the defense lawyers. And that's, to me, just critical. That you can't... You can't tell the authorizing judge something, keep it secret for years, and expect there to be a full hearing on the challenge to necessity.
But our review is a pass-through of the district court, right? The district court reviews the applicant, the judge reviewing the applicant, and we, at least in your argument, we don't defer to the district judge anyway. We similarly review the decision of the applicant judge for whether it's abuse of discretion, right?
Yes.
And you know who Victoria Owens is, and you can tell us everything you want, and you get the full hearing. So I'm not sure how you're harmed by the district judge. If we agree with you, then the wiretaps are out. If we don't agree with you, then they're not.
Well,
what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that had the trial lawyers known that, they could have mounted a far more devastating defense against Victoria Owens than I could do in my brief. I did the best I could with the limited record I had, but I'm confident that they could have done a much better job discrediting Victoria Owens as to credibility and believability. So it does. I believe it does make a difference. Things like her expectations of leniency, I can only allege. They can inquire. Things like her drug use during her cooperation period, I can allege because I have access to a pre-sentence, not a pre-sentence report.
The argument has to be sort of limited to whether the application was appropriate or not, whether there was additional material that should have been provided to the judge, not an argument about whether she's really credible or not. That's up to the judge to make, the judge with the application to make the decision, right?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. I don't think it's the only way, though. The way I prefer to look at it is the government did something in secret. Got the judge to approve it. Didn't tell him everything.
That always happens in a wiretap. It's always in secret from the defense counsel. So we're limited to whatever is in the application. Now, it may be that the application hides something. I understand that argument. But that's an argument either is or is, you know, whether what's hidden is significant or isn't significant is an argument we can review now as well as the district court could have reviewed.
I don't think, I don't want to challenge the court, but I don't
no,
think.
You're entitled to.
I don't think. This court can make the same review if there had been a hearing, if that had been disclosed before Judge Lamberth, the reviewing judge, because those lawyers knew the people involved, they knew the facts, and they could present a far better case than I could on appeal.
Were you entitled to ask the identity of the CWs? The government says that, not you obviously, but the attorney, time, trial attorney, didn't move for disclosure of the identity of the CWs. I would think that would be normally what would happen at that stage. You would move for the identity of the CWs, and you would either get them or not, and the judge would rule about whether you're entitled to them or not, and if you were, then this argument could have been made there.
I can't say. If I didn't run across it, I'm going to agree with the court that that may have been the case, but what I would add is that in this case, I believe it's clear the government made a concerted effort to conceal Victoria Owens' identity, both in pretrial and at the first trial. And that would have discouraged anyone from asking if they didn't think that there's any possibility that CW5 was Victoria Owens. But I do agree with the court. I don't recall seeing that request, and so I'll have to punt and say, no, they didn't. I have a third issue, and that is the right to counsel issue. And I approach this with some trepidation because I'm gonna preface it with, I have the utmost respect for Judge Lamberth. Practiced in front of him for many years, and I don't mean to impugn him. But what I want to argue is the appearance of fairness. And it's based on the following scenario. You have a long drug trial in which a person is accused of offenses that will require a life in prison. That's the first trial. In that trial, the defendant, Mr. Miller, is represented by a lawyer who's appointed to him, who has done, maybe 18 months work on the case. He fights the government tooth and nail and is able to get an acquittal on a few counts. He's convicted on a couple of telephone counts, but he's fought the government to a standstill on the major counts and the major life counts. Jury comes back. 2 weeks later, the government moves to join Mr. Miller to the second group, and that puts his lawyer out of the picture. Mr. Miller wants his first lawyer. His first lawyer has a good reason why he can't go to trial in September. The court then appoints someone over the objection of the appellant, does not listen to the appellant's objections on why he's unprepared, appoints him in a proceeding in which he was not present.
Can I ask, when you say, again, given the respect you have for Judge Lamberth, do you mean that he didn't listen or he just didn't agree with the bottom line?
I think he placed,
It's not as if he refused to hear the argument, right?
Well, in a sense it is. In a sense it is. He refused to hear the appellant. The appellant wrote him several times and said, I want to be heard on this. Mm-hmm. I want to demonstrate why I want my first counsel and not a replacement counsel if he has to go to trial in September.
I thought there was a discussion with the district court where the defendant was present.
You are correct, Your Honor. That occurred in July.
Yes, and I thought that all these objections were made to the district court at that time.
Well, the basis for those objections were made, and I believe that was July 2nd.
There's something on July 18th, too. But anyway.
Yes, there was that's the hearing that I'm talking about. On July 2nd, there was a hearing in which the appellant was present. He wrote a letter on July 15th to the judge, a pro se letter, asking, can he address this issue? On the 17th, 2 days later, obviously Judge Lamberth didn't get the letter by then, but on the 17th, there was a hearing in which Mr. Saunders entered his appearance. I'm sorry, on the 17th, he entered his appearance. On the 18th, there was a status hearing in which the appellant was not present, despite his request. Now, I'll give Judge Lamberth the benefit of the doubt that he didn't get the letter, but once he did get the letter, and there was a follow-up letter on August 30th, when he got those letters, I believe he was under an obligation to listen to the appellant's reasons why his lawyer couldn't be prepared. And that is the appearance of unfairness.
Let me ask you, one of the other attorneys, I thought, had objected to joining Miller.
Mr. Island's lawyer.
And either that defense attorney or another attorney said no new attorney could be ready for this trial if he worked day and night, etc.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the judge had that objection.
Well, he had that objection before he appointed the lawyer.
Yeah.
But once the lawyer was appointed, and assuming he had contact with Mr. Miller, and they talked, and Mr. Miller understood what this lawyer was doing, what he could do in the 6 weeks he was given, that's a turning point. Mr. Miller's not shooting in the dark anymore. He's talking from experience what his replacement counsel can do and cannot do.
So let me ask Mr. Hart, there's no indication in the record that I've found or that anyone has pointed me to where Saunders indicates to the district court he thinks he's going to have any trouble being ready.
You are correct.
As I understand it, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, the district court proceeded along the lines that if any defendant raised an issue, the judge treated it as though all defendants had raised that issue.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So then it shows that, and I don't know the significance of this, that Mr. McDaniel's CJA payments were extended through, what was it, jury selection for the second trial.
Either up to or through, yes.
So from that, are we to infer that essentially the first attorney was to assist the second attorney in getting ready for trial?
You can infer that that was the intention, but whether that occurred, I think the inference cannot be made.
So to me, one of your stronger points was the finding that the district court had made in connection with the speedy trial motion, saying that an attorney would need at least 6 months to prepare, and the argument that was for the first trial.
Yes.
And in the second trial, you had these additional superseding indictments, et cetera, so the case became more complicated in that sense. So you're saying this is a theory about the appearance of fairness.
Well, that's one theory.
Okay, what's the other theory?
The other theory is I would like the court to adopt the right to the right to keep counsel once he's appointed. I know that's a stretch for this court, and I can't base my case on that. But I think there is a recognition that once you have been appointed a counsel that you form a relationship with, that the Sixth Amendment does give you the expectation that he will be your attorney. And that's recognized across the street. It's recognized in a number of state courts.
Is it inconsistent with Slaffy or just
no.
Not?
No.
It's not. They just don't intersect.
I would say they don't intersect because Slaffy stands for the principle that you can't pick someone. This is a principle that once someone's appointed to you and has done work for you and has generated the lawyer-client relationship, the judge cannot arbitrarily interfere with that, whether he's appointed or retained. And that's why we argue that once that relationship is established, the judge has to have a good reason to break that. And we don't believe docket control is a good enough reason to break it in this case. Unless there are questions, we will submit. Thank you.
Hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honors. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Turning to Mr. Miller's final argument in regard to the right to counsel, it's clear that this court and the Supreme Court holdings haven't recognized any Sixth Amendment right to continued representation of appointed counsel, even after an attorney-client relationship has been established. Looking at the Slaffy majority, they specifically stated that there's no right to a meaningful relationship between defense and his counsel, and in that case, they were dealing with a situation where a new public defender had been assigned to the defendant's case 6 days before trial after his first public defender had needed emergency surgery and wasn't available. So based on the factual analysis that was going on in Slaffy, we would say that goes a long way to show that there isn't a relationship or a Sixth Amendment right to that sort of continued relationship with appointed counsel.
Counsel is making two other arguments, as I understand.
That's correct. And our point on that, those other arguments, is first of all, even in cases where in other jurisdictions they have recognized that kind of right to a continued appointment of counsel relationship, the trial court, those are qualified rights. Trial court retains discretion to interfere with that right so long as it's not done arbitrarily, and in this case that's exactly what happened. There was no arbitrary interference with any sort of right to representation.
What about
on Mr. Miller's behalf?
This was such a complex case, attorneys taking 18 months to work on it, to prepare. The new attorney has 7 weeks. And the judge has already found that a defense attorney needs at least 6 months.
Those findings in regard to, for instance, the speedy trial clock and so forth were made back, and I believe it was December or January of 2004, which is a long time before the case had come to fruition in the first trial.
I know, but
you have
here
is, I'm sorry.
It got more complicated. And the second trial got more complicated still since there were these superseding indictments. That's the argument at any rate.
That's the argument, but I don't believe that's the fact. And what happened really is at the status hearing on June 26th, when the parties were all there and they were discussing the replacement of counsel, the government told defense counsel and told the court that essentially the same evidence is going to go on in the second trial as was put on in the first trial. I believe the word the government used was it's going to be a duplicate. And they were assuring the court and the other parties that joining Miller wasn't going to extend the trial and involve a huge amount of new evidence coming in and so forth. So when you have counsel,
no burden on the government.
Well, no burden on the other parties either.
But a burden on new counsel, that's the issue.
The burden on new counsel then, given that he's now knows that it's essentially going to be the same trial, is to learn the last trial, and he has a complete roadmap to that. He's already been, the court at that time had already was gearing up to get new counsel ready. You have a roadmap, you're going to get all the trial discs, you're going to get representation continued for Mr. McDaniels through the beginning of whenever jury selection begins in the second trial.
So you just ought to be a copycat, not an independent advisor to your client?
No, that's not the case, but certainly he has to do his own research and his own preparation and analyze the case in the manner he sees fit. But the point is saying that there were speedy trial issues over 2 years before this occurred is not to say that the same situation exists at the time that
no,
the first trial is ended.
Some indication that
happen.
The district court acknowledged that this was a complex case, lots of discovery, lots of tapes, 24,000 tapes, you know, et cetera.
And we're not denying there was a lot of discovery and there were a lot of calls and so forth, but you have a situation where you have a roadmap from the first case. You have Mr. McDaniel's continued representation up through the beginning of jury selection, whenever that occurs, and you have the government telling the defense that you're pretty much going to hear the same evidence you heard in the first case. You have Mr. McDaniel's
so
even coming to...
So is this case saved by the fact that whatever the state courts may have held, in this case, there is no demonstration of prejudice to
Miller? That's correct. There's no demonstration of prejudice, and more importantly, there's no demonstration that the district court arbitrarily replaced Mr. Miller's counsel.
Well, that's the question. And if there's no prejudice, we don't have to reach that, do we?
That's correct. If there's no prejudice, you don't have to reach that. But I would say that it's clear from the record that the court ensured that Mr. Miller was going to have competent replacement counsel. When he had that two-page hearing, I'm not even sure I could call it a hearing. It was an approval of the appointment of Mr. Saunders to represent Mr. Miller on July 18th. The court noted there that Mr. Saunders' calendar had been cleared so he could work on this case. The court was willing to postpone individual voir dire if Mr. Saunders needed more time. The court had already at that point signed vouchers so Mr. Saunders could promptly get his first trial transcripts. He kept Mr. McDaniel's appointment intact until the start of the second trial, and he expressed a willingness to hold a status conference anytime that Mr. Saunders asked him. So you have a situation where the court isn't acting arbitrarily, and after that point, you don't have Mr. Saunders ever coming back to the court saying, I'm unprepared, even despite the fact that there has been this acknowledgement by the court that they're going to give Mr. Saunders, in fact, the time he needs. Turning to the pro se letters, they obviously hadn't been received by the court until August in this case, and they didn't say anything specific, as Judge Rogers, you had noted, I believe. They didn't have any particular objections. All they did was really restate the notion that Mr. Miller didn't think that anybody could be ready within the time frame. He never says that he's having any difficulty working with Mr. Saunders and so forth.
So do you read Slappy, since it didn't adopt the Brennan approach, to be inconsistent with this argument that Mr. Hart is raising?
I don't know that I can say that Slappy has undermine the argument, because it wasn't entirely clear that when they're saying a meaningful relationship that they were saying that an appointed attorney and an indigent client, there's no right to continued counsel once an attorney-client relationship has been established. But I would say, in saying that there's no right to a meaningful relationship between the client and his counsel, that the court was addressing a situation where essentially the defendant was seeking to have his original counsel put back onto the case when that counsel had been replaced 6 days before trial. So factually, it's similar to this case. But of course, here we had much more time. We had 7 weeks before jury selection. And in addition to that, there was another month. The actual opening arguments didn't happen until October 3rd, 2006 in this case. So it's an even longer period of time. If I could turn to the wiretap arguments, if the court would be willing. First of all, in regard to Mr. Miller's argument, it's very clear that the identity of CW5 as Victoria Owens was not masked from the authorizing judge in this case, Judge Roberts. And there's certainly no situation or no evidence that the defense ever sought to find out who CW5 was. They never moved to disclose the identity of CW5 or any of the cooperators before the suppression motion.
What's your general response to the notion that even as to the unmasking of her, the authorizing judge didn't have a full account of her, and indeed the affidavit made a misstatement of fact about her, and the notion that it wasn't full and complete, and so the judge was unable to do the necessity and probable cause analysis?
Well, I don't think that's correct. Even when you look at the affidavit itself, of course, you know, it doesn't go into the type of detail that Mr. Miller has now parsed out on appeal many years later, but it's clear from the affidavit itself that it showed that the CW5 had been cooperating since October 2003 in this case. It had described CW5's really quite heavy involvement in the trafficking of heroin. She was involved in the drug operation. She provided information, regarding 45 different targets of the investigation. And
so is that the corroboration?
My point in mentioning this is that the court knew that CW5 was a cooperator, and of course as a cooperator she could factor in that she had credibility and motives in potentially testifying as a government witness and so forth.
Is that the corroboration of her credibility, the things you've just mentioned?
The corroboration of credibility, there was additional detail within the affidavit itself that were specific examples of her that the information that she had given in this case about this investigation had in fact been corroborated. Looking at the Miller affidavit, it's the defense appendix 277 and 78. CW5 had told of an incident in which Miller, Elon, Mr. Gaskins, and another dealer, Craig Simon, had all met at CW5's house. And in that situation, Elon had given Mr. Gaskins $3,000 approximately to wire through Western Union. And Agent Sparks had verified through Western Union records after that Gaskins had wired $3,400 to a woman in Miami and that information, or that money rather, was never claimed. We have another incident that's discussed at page 278 and 79 where CW5 said that Miller uses this subject phone number one, the phone that was at issue in getting the wiretap, to conduct his drug business. And then going on in the affidavit further, 279, 280, pages 299 through 305, there's a lengthy detail of toll record and pen register information that's confirming that phone is being used to call other targets, a cocaine dealer, Mr. Miller's aunt, whose house had been searched previously, and heroin distribution paraphernalia had been found. So those are just a few incidences, and there are further within the affidavit itself showing that the agents had been able to corroborate information that CW5 had given them regarding this investigation.
So counsel is just wrong in telling us that there was no evidence provided to the authorizing judge about how CW5's credibility was corroborated.
Yeah, I think that's correct, because when you look at within the affidavit itself, they are giving examples of corroboration, and you also have a broader statement at page 270.
So then he says
they're saying it was corroborated through undercover buys and so forth.
Moving on, he says it wasn't full and complete. the judge couldn't make the necessary determinations.
Well, we believe it was full and complete. What you have under the necessity requirement is that you don't have to give every detail of every possible thing that could be relevant to your investigation in order to satisfy the necessity requirement.
What do you have to provide?
You have to provide sufficient information to show that the information within the warrant is, in fact, accurate, that that you have used
information in the affidavit is accurate. You said warrant. I just want to be sure
I'm sorry. I'm mixing up search warrants and affidavits for wiretaps at this point. Essentially, all you have to show...
In other words, is it that the judge has to find that based on the evidence he's provided that, there's a reasonable probability that authorizing the wiretaps will lead to information relevant to the charged offenses, or not the charged offenses.
Essentially, it's evaluating the probable cause element. You're giving
it's reasonable
to see
probability.
If
I'm just trying to understand what it is.
The language that I've seen in cases, the Fairchild case and the Eighth Circuit, does the totality of the circumstances reveal that there's a fair probability that the wiretap will uncover evidence of a crime?
And have we adopted that?
I know that the court looks at the totality of the circumstances analysis. I'm not sure if that was the exact... I haven't seen a particular case in the D.C. Circuit.
What about the Supreme Court?
I believe that they're usually... many of the cases that I've seen cited go back to Illinois v. Gates, which is similar, if not the same language. And as for necessity, as the court's noted, you're looking at the judge's decision under an abuse of discretion standard and asking were the facts supporting necessity minimally adequate to support a grant of the wiretap at this point.
I mean, what I'm getting at is that when I first started prosecuting, it's very hard to get wiretaps.
Yes.
Then the war on drugs came, and it became very easy to get wiretaps. And now we're a little beyond that. And the question is sort of where is the pendulum in terms of the burden that has to be overcome before you can invade a presumptively innocent person's privacy?
The burden on the necessity prong is that have traditional techniques proven inadequate to reveal the full nature and scope of the operation. That's the language that, if I'm pronouncing it right, the Sobomowu decision.
So the argument here is that Dermot had 7 cooperating witnesses, some of whom were unidentified. We don't know whether they ever asked CW5 to serve in this manner. It had a search warrant, the proceeds from the search warrant, whatever was seized. It had other traditional methods of investigating this alleged conspiracy. So what made it necessary to not explore those other means before tapping someone's phone?
Well, I think the affidavit made clear that the agents had explored those other means, and they laid out in great detail in the affidavit all the other means that they had used and what limitations they were running up against.
About some of the cooperating witnesses. In other words, what I'm trying to understand is it's easier to get a tap than it is to do all this legwork. All right, I understand that. So what is the burden here? I mean, you say you've got cooperating witnesses, and you identify some of them, but one of them, can't tell you everything you need to know.
The gist of it was that none of them can tell us everything we need to know. Particularly the affidavit had explained, it's at page A310 at paragraph 91 of the affidavit for the first Miller wire. Agent Sparks has specifically explained the inability to discover various things through the cooperators. Number one, like the means by which the drugs were being obtained, the manner and the timetable that heroin shipments were coming into the area, the location where the drugs were being stashed, where any assets from the operation were being hidden.
It used to be done more with undercovers, and they don't do that as much now.
They did do undercover buys in this case, according to the affidavit. Agent Sparks had said, in fact, that they had corroborated some of CW5's information through undercover buys and surveillance.
They infiltrate the entire organization.
They couldn't infiltrate the entire organization. And, again, that's another way that the affidavit explained it. Page A312, it said, these are the ways that the traditional investigative techniques that we have used and, frankly, still continue to use. They didn't just turn on the wire and then forget everything else, as is shown very clearly in the continuing extension affidavits. But the agent had explained within the affidavit that they'd fallen short of achieving investigative goals, such as identifying other co-conspirators, including who were the heroin transporters and the distributors. What are the quantities of drugs that are being transported? Where are those drugs being stored? How often are the heroin transports coming into D.C.? And what kind of prices are being paid for buying and selling heroin? And you know, where are the resources from these transactions being hidden? The affidavit also said that there hadn't been any cooperating source that had access to the stash locations that were being used by the main suppliers, and that they'd, on 315, that they'd only been able to develop one cooperator that was outside the drug operation that Mr. Miller had been willing to reveal any aspects of that drug operation to. So this is not some lofty goal on we're wondering if the heroin is coming from Afghanistan or something like that. These are very basic facts that they had detailed were unable to be found through the traditional investigative techniques that they had been using and detailed in the affidavit and then continued to use. So it certainly has shown, as required, that traditional techniques proved inadequate to reveal the full nature and scope of the operation, which is the test that the circuit has used. So we believe that this 62-page affidavit from Mr. Miller's first wiretap, it amply shows that there was necessity in this case.
Want to respond to Mr. Hart's arguments about the agents?
Certainly. I would say just specifically, there was no overall summary witness. I know that the overview word has been bantered around and so forth. There was no one that testified at the second trial as to a summary or a preview of the government's evidence in this case. In regard to Agent Bevington, he had a number of different topics that he testified about, and certainly given the Moore decision that came out after this case, we do have a situation where his discussion about the development of cooperators in general is certainly a problem, but we would submit that there is no ability to show that there was prejudice or to meet the Alana fourth prong in this case.
Well, counsel, and you heard counsel's argument in the last case about why this case is different from Hampton.
Oh, I was speaking to Agent Bevington, but if Your Honor would like to, Agent Hall in this case was the one that interpreted the wiretap calls. There was only one agent. If the court would like me to turn to the Hampton issue, I'm happy to. Again, this is a very different situation, and again, you know, given the agent's testimony that he had developed some of his interpretations based on his knowledge of the investigation in general, that's no longer allowed under Hampton. But however, we have here, unlike Hampton, you had numerous other witnesses. You didn't have one problematic witness like Velma Williams in the Hampton decision. You had at least six other cooperators that testified regarding Miller's and Elon's role in the case. You had a lot of physical evidence that was linking Mr. Elon and Mr. Miller to the drug operation here. You had four kilograms of powder cocaine that was seized, that was brought in from Arizona by Tyrone Thomas, and you had an interdicted package of heroin that Mr. Miller had arranged to have delivered to his cousin Charles Brown. You had Mr. Miller's house being searched. They found acetone that's used to process PCB. There's guns, ammunition, surveillance devices, bug detectors that were the same bug detectors that were found then in Mr.
So it's
Elon's
the physical
apartment.
Evidence, right?
The physical evidence, and more so, even beyond that, in this case, we have arguments that are very different. Here we have a situation where Mr. Miller himself called Agent Hall as a defense witness to interpret 17 different calls to support his defense that Mr. Miller is just speaking innocently on the phone. So that's very different. You don't have in Hampton them relying on that same agent that they're trying to undermine the credibility of.
Well, they're stuck with him after the prosecutor calls him, so you try to make the best of it.
They knew he was going to be called, and they did their best, which is another reason why there is no prejudice here. Even in opening, Eland was saying the agents that are going to interpret these calls, they're going to stretch too far, and they're just agents. They're thinking like law enforcement, and they're going to interpret everything as drug-related. You know, if you're talking about the weather, they're going to say it's drug-related, so watch out for that. You have Mr. Miller's opening where he's just saying the agents are merely going to give their opinion and you, the jury, has to decide what the real evidence is, which, frankly, is the exact same thing, and again, that makes this very different.
Well, I think more importantly, it's the judge's instruction to the jury, isn't it? It's
which, key. That is very important, Your Honor, and of course the judge did instruct here.
That's right, more than opening arguments.
That's correct, but I think another very key thing here is that you had the government in rebuttal closing telling the jury you don't need Hall's opinions. You went on for two paragraphs saying
that you know now
what the agent knew. You can ignore his opinion. And you can just look to all the other evidence in the case that he was basing his interpretations on. And I mean, telling the jury before final jury instructions that they don't need Hall's opinion, that they're, after hearing all the evidence in the case, in the same position that Agent Hall is in, because now they have the same information
in front of them. In my view, overcome what this court has held for a long time about what the dangers are of having these vouching FBI agents testify.
Well, the danger is, as I've understood it, is that the agents are somehow relaying to the jury that they have information that the jury doesn't have in evidence.
That's
that makes them more
There's
able.
Three different concerns, and all of them can't be overcome, in my view, by a closing argument like the one you're talking about.
I would submit also, as the court has noted, that there were the jury instructions that this person is just giving their lay opinion, that it's ultimately the jury's determination as to all the credibility of all the witnesses.
So I was going to ask about that. Was there any limiting instruction given at the time either Bevington or Hall testified?
Well, Agent Bevington testified as an expert, if you'll recall, because he had no involvement in the investigation in this
was
case.
Was there any limiting instruction given at the time Bevington or Hall testified?
When Bevington testified, the court instructed that he was an expert witness, he was testifying as an expert, and that the jury didn't have to accept him necessarily just because he was an expert. The standard instruction that you give for
experts. And how about Hall?
For Agent Hall, he testified as a lay opinion witness. I believe that the jury was told that he was testifying as to his lay opinion. I know they were told that during the final jury instructions, and I'm just trying to recall whether or not
I know in Moore we focused on the fact that at the time the agents were presented, there were special instructions to the jury before the agents testified, so the jury would know how to receive their evidence. And I just wondered if that happened in this case.
I know that there was an expert instruction when Agent Bevington testified, and then in final instructions, there was an lay opinion instruction given in the final instructions. I don't recall whether or not one was given before Agent Hall testified at trial.
Okay.
But in addition to that, we just believe that in regard to Agent Hall, we're in a very different situation given the physical evidence, the arguments that were made, and the fact that Mr. Miller called Agent Hall himself to help bolster his case. We're just not in the same situation in regard to harmlessness or the fourth prong of Bolano as we were in that case. And in regard to Agent Bevington, again, there's no ability to show prejudice or the fourth prong of Olano because the defense, again, is eliciting similar evidence from Agent Bevington on cross as is the government. They're talking about conspirator secrecy and investigative techniques in drug cases. They're discussing...
in other words, the point, though, there is that the government never should have been allowed to present this type of testimony.
Well, and given that...
the defense... call him as a witness.
But if they're developing, as this court has said a long time ago in Skidkowski, that if you're going to get up and develop the same kind of evidence in cross as the government has put on in its direct, it's very difficult to show prejudice in that
after
situation.
After you've objected and filed a motion objecting to any 701 witness, it's a different situation, it seems to me.
I would definitely argue there was nothing in the 701-702 argument that was presented to the district court that previewed anything Hampton-like. I mean, we're talking about a situation where they were saying essentially that
we object
because we didn't get discovery about agents. And essentially they're just saying if this person is going to testify, and this is certainly how the district court interpreted it, was that agents can testify. If they're going to testify about what they learned in this case, then it can come, those agents come in under 701 as lay opinion witnesses. If the agent's going to testify based on all his experience in drug cases in general, for instance, then that person has to be qualified as an expert, and in that situation you get Rule 16 discovery. So we're not teeing up in that scenario for the court anything Hampton-like. We were just talking about whether or not this person's going to testify under 701 or 702. And you know, frankly, until the Hampton decision came out, the argument that Mr. Eland was forwarding in his brief was that basically that Agent Hall wasn't helpful to the jury, and under 701B, he shouldn't have been allowed to testify. That, again, is a very different objection. But we would certainly strongly argue, particularly since Agent Bevington had no involvement in this case, and that was brought out very clearly in his testimony by both parties, that, and then given that.
But you already admitted he vouched.
He didn't vouch for anybody, particularly in this case.
He vouched for cooperating witnesses.
In the general sense of.
I mean, I read his testimony.
Right, right. But he's talking in general, this is what we do when we have cooperators. Right. He certainly wasn't speaking as to any of the individual cooperators in this case, and we think that's significant. Again, the information that was brought out in the court's instructions, we would submit, undermine any sort of prejudice argument in this case. I believe I've hit everything, but the only thing I would say in addition, I believe there was some argument that the wiretap extensions were improper in this case, and we would submit in regard to that the extension affidavits met the requirements, which is only under 2518.1F, that you inform the court realistically appraise of the probability that relevant calls are going to be here in the future, and that's exactly what happened here. And all these affidavits coming after the first Miller affidavit gave lengthy summaries, some going on more than 20 pages, regarding calls that had been intercepted, regarding, in particular, Mr. Miller's use of the phone. So the idea that he also used pay phones and landlines certainly doesn't undermine the notion that it was proper for them to extend the wiretap for Mr. Miller. Clearly, in that case, there was 871 pertinent calls that were summarized in 21 pages that were obtained during the first period of the wiretap. So it's clear that he's using those phones in regard to the drug operations. I believe that I've hit all the points that I would like to make.
I know this wasn't argued, but I'd just like to ask you a question about the continuing criminal enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the five people.
Five.
Yeah.
People directed, yes.
Let me just see where I got that. That. I want to ask you about what your strongest evidence is as to one of the players. Let me get my notes. You probably know which one I mean.
I'm not sure. I can list names if that would refresh the court's recollection.
Jay Ingram.
Jay Ingram, yes.
And what's your strongest evidence as to Ingram?
I believe the strongest evidence as to Mr. Ingram is that he was a lieutenant in the drug organization, and he's Mr. Miller's cousin, and that he's
The first statement is a conclusion. What's the evidence to show that? The fact he was a cousin, I don't think that gets you anywhere.
That did come out in trial that he was Mr. Miller's cousin.
But that's not a criminal offense.
No, that's not a criminal offense, and we're not saying that. And frankly, even the direction, I don't believe, has to be a specific criminal offense.
If you can just focus and tell me what it is as to Jay Ingram.
Sure. I have Jay Ingram told Ricky Gore, who was another lieutenant in the operation, that Mr. Miller had supplied his PCP. You have another instance that was brought out at trial where Mr. Elon needed to get crack, so he called Miller and is looking for Mr. Ingram. So, of course, he's looking for Mr. Ingram through Mr. Miller to get the crack and says, okay, Mr. Miller says he's right.
Who was looking for?
Mr. Elon was looking,
Elon is looking for
Mr. Ingram because he needed to get some crack. I believe he needed an eight ball of crack.
Elon looking for
Mr.
Ingram.
J. Ingram.
For an
eight ball of crack, I believe.
And an eight ball of crack is what? I mean, is that...
He calls Mr. Miller, essentially, on the phone.
I mean, how
find,
much crack is that?
I used to know. I'm sorry. I believe it's...
But what is a ball? Is it milligrams?
I think it's 2 ounces.
It's two ounces. It's a rather large... It's a distribution amount. I can certainly
okay,
sure
that's
call
what
it
I
that.
Need to
it's not a minor amount.
Okay.
He calls Mr. Miller to find Mr. Ingram, and Mr. Miller says... He's right here with me, and Mr. Elon then says, I'm going to go, yeah, stay where you are, I'm coming to your location. So you have that situation. Again, you have information through other witnesses that Mr. Ingram is a lieutenant in the drug organization. That came out at trial, and under this court's decision,
go back. That's a conclusion. What did he do that shows he's a lieutenant? That's what I'm trying to understand.
He was getting distribution amounts of PCP from Mr. Miller. I believe there's evidence in the testimony at trial that he was out in the 9th Street area dealing drugs. And so the notion that he is a lieutenant is properly brought forward through the evidence, and as this court had said on Wilson, lieutenants are generally considered managees
so
for CCP purposes.
So he's getting PCP for Miller, and the strongest evidence of that is this telephone call when...
Mr. Gore's testimony, Ricky Gore, he was another lieutenant in the operation. He testified that Ingram had told him that Mr. Miller supplied all his PCP.
Now, I had the five people... And maybe I'm wrong. Ames, Ingram, Thomas, Brown. And who's the fifth?
We had Timothy Thomas and then Tyrone Thomas.
So the two Thomases.
That's correct.
Right. I didn't have the man you just mentioned.
Mr. Gore?
Yeah.
Mr. Gore was not one of the people that...
He was
that,
not a lieutenant.
He was a lieutenant, but
he was.
From a supervision point of view, it seemed that the... vast majority of the evidence at trial was that Mr. Elon was supervising him rather than Mr. Miller.
Okay.
And since we were just talking about solely Mr. Miller's CC sufficiency, we did not...
So it's that... What is it that you're saying, Jay... Who told Gore that Miller had supplied his PCP?
No, Mr. Ingram had told Ricky Gore that Miller was his PCP supplier. I can get the clue.
Okay, and then you have the second part is the telephone call where Elon's looking for Ingram for this distributable amount
of crack cocaine, yes.
Okay, and is that it, basically?
Those are the main points. There's also information that Mr. Ingram knew of apartment 1510, which was the stash apartment for the drugs. He also had met with Miller and Eland, which was verified through surveillance. At the time, Tyrone Thomas, who was supposed to be bringing the 4 kilograms of crack across country from Arizona, there came a time during that operation that Tyrone Thomas had said that the cocaine was missing as a ruse, and that there's surveillance supporting that Ingram and Miller and Mr. Elon got together at this place called the Star Carryout immediately after a bunch of discussions over the phone discussing this problem with Tyrone Thomas. Additionally, there was further testimony that Mr. Briggs, Rayshon Briggs, who was also involved as a dealer in this operation, had dealt with Miller, Ingram, and Elin to get his drugs, I believe, from for a long period of time. Recalling probably about the year 2000, if I'm recalling correctly. So, and I think it's important to note, too, that when you're talking about a managerial relationship, the courts have found that that relationship is flexible and that any sort of managerial period can be quite brief. There's no time limitation on how much managing has to go on. It can be directions for a brief period of time or a lengthy period of time. So for those reasons, we believe that the evidence is sufficient to find that there were five people supervised in regard to Mr. Miller's continuing criminal enterprise conviction.
Further questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We respectfully request that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Mr. Hart, whether you have time left or not, since we gave the government an extra time. Oh, I can't remember which of the two of you went first. We'll give you both some extra time, given that we gave the government.
I just want to clarify one point about the CW5 information. I don't know what I stated, but I had argued in brief that it had been corroborated. And what the point I was trying to make, which particular methods of the investigation, after they failed to disclose, which particular methods of investigation had proven successful in corroborating CW5 information, and why they could not continue to be used. That was the point that I was trying to make if I stated that nothing had been corroborated. I don't know why I said that if I said it, but the court said. But yeah, because in the brief I said it had been corroborated. Just, but the point I was trying to make is just that why they couldn't continue to use those methods to continue to corroborate that information.
Thank you. Mr. Hart?
Thank you.
There was no special instruction for Agent Hall. As a 701 witness.
There was one for the expert witness.
Yes, for the 702 agent Bevington. I disagree. He was a summary witness. He did precondition the jury to accept the government's cooperators. CCE evidence that the government mentions in its presentation does not demonstrate a managerial control. With one phone call, they met. He knew something about an apartment. In fact, because they all met and got drugs from each other, it indicates they were not managers. Mr. Miller was not a manager of Mr. Ingram.
I'm puzzled about this. This is not raised, that is, these specific attacks on individuals. This was not raised in either your opening or your reply brief, right?
Then I'll
I don't mean that it's not entirely answered, but which I mean is that you sort of threw up the issue, not enough for the CCE, but there's no specific attack on...
Oh, so I understand, Your Honor.
As Ingram being... for example, the evidence against England.
I live in a world of limited words. Sometimes I have to...
Well, let me put it this way. When you raise the question about the sufficiency of the evidence of the CCE, I looked to see what evidence there was. All right, and when I looked, I thought the weakest was as to Jay Ingram. So that's why I asked the prosecutor, so that you could respond and I would just get your take on it.
A buyer-seller relationship does not establish managerial control. One phone call, a meeting, knowledge of an apartment does not establish managerial control.
Does not establish, if you were the juror or are on our review now, which is sufficiency of the evidence.
Your review
no
now.
Reasonable juror conclude that he was taking directions and he wasn't just a buyer-seller. I mean, I didn't hear any testimony. I don't see any testimony at the trial suggesting that he was only a buyer-seller. We have him taking direction in a couple of examples of Ingram telling Gore that he got his PCP from him. Maybe it's as a buyer-seller, maybe it's the other way, but could no reasonable juror have concluded that? They testified that I think Ames testified almost very, very few people knew about the stash house and that he was one of only three, I think. He Ingram, Miller, and Island and Ames, the four of them, were the only ones who knew about it. Briggs said that he got his crack from, and he described them as a combination, Miller and Island and Ingram. I'm not saying that as a juror I would necessarily have voted this way, but the question is, could no reasonable juror have concluded that there was more than merely a buyer-seller relationship?
In my view, yes.
But why?
Because there are so many either alternative explanations or contradictory explanations. when someone calls for drugs and he has to be referred to another party, that doesn't mean that intermediary party is a controller or a manager. It means that that one person doesn't have the drugs to supply. So,
but I thought it was that Island was looking for Ingram to get the eight ball of crack.
Yes.
And he called Miller.
Yes.
For that purpose.
And that does not make Miller a manager of Ingram. It makes him someone who knows that he's right next to him. And was one point I underlined, and that was that the word lieutenant, I don't think, is mentioned by any of the civilian witnesses.
No, you're right. It's only the opinion evidence, and Judge Rogers made that clear. I think that's quite right. There's no nothing other than a characterization.
I'd like to close again with an answer by Agent Hall to one of the recordings, and this has to do with James Ingram. He listened to a call that they played, and Agent Hall said, "They're cousins." Question, do you have an opinion on what this call is about? Agent Hall answered, "My opinion is that this is them trying to meet up. Throughout the course of this investigation, you would see people attempting to meet up with Mr. Miller, and Mr. Miller trying to meet up with other people to either, you know, perform some sort of narcotics transaction or money transaction. I can't think of any more damning testimony for the government's misuse of this agent's testimony, and we would submit on that. Thank you."
Thank you very much. Both of you were again appointed, both Mr. Hart and Mr. Kirchman were appointed by the court. We very much appreciate your work. Mr. Hart, I've seen your work several times, and your briefs are extremely good, and we appreciate that. Someday I'll be able to say that about Mr. Kirchman if I see more of them, but so far I've only seen yours. Cases under submission.